He keeps letting you down and disappointing you. I know he loves you, but that's not enough. Apparently, I'm not the only one he loves. Maybe he started dating her to try to forget you, Emma said. And then he got you back, even though he didn't expect to. And he didn't know how to break it off with her. What an idiot, said Christina. I mean, if it were true, which it isn't. Emma laughed. Okay, yeah, I don't buy it either. She leaned forward. Look, just let me beat him up for you. You'd feel so much better. Emma, no. Don't lay a hand on him, I mean it. I could beat him up with my feet, Emma suggested. They're registered as lethal weapons. She wiggled them. You have to promise not to touch him. Christina glared so severely that Emma raised her free hand in submission. All right, I promise, she said. I will not touch perfect Diego. And you can't yell at Zara either, Christina said. It's not her fault. I'm sure she has no idea I exist. Then I feel sorry for her, Emma said, because you are one of the greatest people I know. Christina started to smile. The sun was almost completely down now. A year with Christina, Emma thought. A year away from everything, from everyone that reminded her of Jules. A year to forget, if she could bear it. Christina gave a little gasp. Look, there it is. The sky flashed green. Emma closed her eyes and wished. When Emma got back to her bedroom, she was surprised to find Mark and Julian already there, each of them standing on opposite sides of her bed, their arms crossed over their chests. How is she? Mark said as soon as the door closed behind Emma. Christina, I mean. His gaze was anxious. Julian's was stonier. He looked blank and autocratic, which Emma knew meant he was angry. Is she upset?
Of course she's upset, Emma said. I think not so much because he's been her boyfriend for a few weeks again, but because they've known each other for so long. Their lives are completely entwined.
Where is she now? Mark said.
Helping Diana and the others fix up the rooms for the Centaurians, Emma said.
You wouldn't think carrying sheets and towels around would cheer anyone up, but she promises it will.
In Faerie, I would challenge Rosales to a duel for this, said Mark. He broke his promise, and a love promise at that. He would meet me in combat if Christina consented to let me be her champion.
Well, no luck there, Emma said. Christina made me promise not to lay a hand on him, and I bet that goes for you two, too.
So you're saying there's nothing we can do?
Mark scowled, a scowl that matched Julian's. There was something about the two of them, Emma thought. Light and dark, though they were, they seemed more like brothers at this moment than they had in a long time.
We can go help set up the bedroom so Christina can go to sleep, Emma said. Diego's locked in one of the offices with Zara, so it's not like she's going to run into him, but she could use the rest.
We're going to get revenge on Diego by folding his towels, Julian said.
They're not technically his towels, Emma pointed out. They're his friend's towels.
She headed for the door, the two boys following reluctantly. It was clear they would have preferred mortal combat on the Greens ward to making hospital corners for Centaurians. Emma wasn't looking forward to it herself. Julian was a lot better at making beds and doing laundry than she was.
I could watch Tavi, she suggested.
Mark had gone ahead of her down the corridor, and she found herself walking beside Julian.
He's asleep, he said.
He didn't mention how he'd found time to put Tavi to bed in between everything else that had happened. That was Julian. He found the time.
You know what strikes me as odd?
What? Emma said.
Diego must have known his cover would be blown, said Julian.
Even if he wasn't expecting Zara to come with the other Centaurians tonight. They all know about her. One of them would have mentioned his fiancée or his engagement.
Good point. Diego might be dishonest, but he's not an idiot.
There are ways you could hurt him without touching him, Julian said. He said it very low so that only Emma could hear him, and there was something dark in his voice, something that made her shiver. She turned to reply but saw Diana coming down the hall toward them, her expression very much that of someone who has caught people slacking off. She dispatched them to different parts of the Institute, Julian to the attic to check on Arthur, Mark to the kitchen, and Emma to the library to help the twins clean up. Kit had disappeared. "He hasn't run away," Ty informed her helpfully. "He just didn't want to make the beds." It was late by the time they'd finished cleaning up, figured out which bedroom to assign to which Centaurian, and made arrangements for food to be delivered the next day. They also set up a patrol to circle the Institute in shifts during the night to watch for rogue sea demons. Heading down the corridor to her room, Emma noticed that a light was shining out from under Julian's door. In fact, the door was cracked partway open. Music drifted into the hallway. Without conscious volition, she found herself in front of his room, her hand raised to knock on the door. In fact, she had knocked. She dropped her hand, half in shock, but he had already flung the door open. She blinked at him. He was in old pajama bottoms, with a towel flung over his shoulder, a paintbrush in one hand. There was paint on his bare chest and some in his hair. Though he wasn't touching her, she was aware of his body, the warmth of him, the black spiraling marks winding down his torso like vines wreathing a pillar. She had put some of them there herself, back in the days when touching him didn't make her hands shake. "Did you want something?" he asked. "It's late, and Mark is probably waiting for you." "Mark?" She had almost forgotten Mark for a moment. "I saw him go into your room." Paint dripped from his brush, splattered on the floor. She could see past him into his room. She hadn't been inside it for what felt like forever. There was plastic sheeting on some of the floor, and she could see brighter spots on his wall where he'd clearly been retouching the mural that ran halfway around the room. She remembered when he'd painted it, after they'd gotten back from Idris, after the Dark War. They'd been lying awake in bed, as they often did, as they had since they were small children. Emma had been talking about how she'd found a book of fairy tales in the library, the kind that mundanes had read hundreds of years ago, how they'd been bloody and full of murder and sadness. She'd spoken of the castle in Sleeping Beauty, surrounded by thorns, and how the story had said that hundreds of princes had tried to break through the barrier to rescue the princess, but they'd all been pierced to death by thorns, their bodies left to whiten to bones in the sun. The next day, Julian had painted his room, the castle and the wall of thorns, the glint of bone and the sad prince, his sword broken at his side. Emma had been impressed, even though they'd had to sleep in her room for a week while the paint dried. She'd never asked him why the image or the story called to him. She'd always known that if he wanted to tell her, he would. Emma cleared her throat. "You said I could hurt Diego without laying a hand on him. What did you mean?" He pushed his free hand through his hair. He looked disheveled. And so gorgeous it hurt. "It's probably better I don't tell you." "He hurt Christina," Emma said, "and I don't even think he cares." He reached up to rub the back of his neck. The muscles in his chest and stomach moved when he stretched, and she was aware of the texture of his skin and wished desperately she could turn back time somehow and be again the person who wasn't shaken to pieces by seeing Julian, who she'd grown up with and seen half-clothed a million times with his shirt off. "I saw his face when Christina ran out of the entry hall," he said. "I don't think you need to worry that he isn't in any pain." He put his hand on the doorknob. "No one can read someone else's mind or guess all their reasons," he said. "Not even you, Emma." He shut the door in her face. Mark was sprawled on the floor at the foot of Emma's bed. His feet were bare. He was half rolled in a blanket. He looked asleep, his eyes shadowy crescents against his pale skin, but he half opened the blue one when she came in.
"Is she really all right?"
"Christina?" "Yes." Emma sat down on the floor beside him, leaning against the footboard. "It sucks, but she'll be okay."
"It would be hard, I think," he said in his sleep-thickened voice, "to deserve her."
"You like her," she said, "don't you?"
He rolled onto his side and looked at her with that searching fairy gaze that made her feel as if she stood alone in a field, watching the wind stir the grass. Of course I like her.
Emma cursed the intensity of fairy language. Like meant nothing to them. They lived in a world of love or hate, scorn or adoration.
Your heart feels something for her, she said.
Mark sat up.
She would not, I think, feel that way about me.
Why not? Emma said. She certainly isn't stuck up about fairies, you know that. She's fond of you.
She is kind. Gentle, generous-hearted, sensible, thoughtful, kind. You said kind already.
Mark glared.
She's nothing like me.
You don't have to be like someone to love them, said Emma. Look at you and me. We're pretty similar, and we don't feel that way about each other.
Only because you're involved with someone else,
Mark spoke matter-of-factly, but Emma looked at him in surprise.
He knows about Jules, she thought for a moment of panic, before she remembered her lie about Cameron.
Too bad, isn't it, she said lightly, trying to keep her heart from hammering. You and I, together, it would have been such an easy thing.
Passion is not easy, nor is the lack of it.
Mark leaned into her. His shoulder was warm against hers. She remembered their kiss, thought of her fingers in his soft hair, his body against hers, responsive and strong. But even as she tried to grip tight to the image, it slid away between her fingers like dry sand, like the sand on the beach the night Julian and she had lain there, the only night they had together.
You look sad, said Mark. I am sorry to have brought up the matter of love.
He touched her cheek.
In another life, perhaps. You and I.
Emma let her head fall back against the footboard.
In another life.
Chapter 6. They're the Traveler. Since the kitchen was too small to hold the inhabitants of the Institute plus 20-odd Centaurians, breakfast was set up in the dining room. Portraits of Blackthorne's past looked down on plates of eggs and bacon and racks of toast. Christina moved unobtrusively among the crowd, trying not to be seen. She doubted she would have come down at all if it hadn't been for her desperate need for coffee. She looked around for Emma and Mark, but neither of them were here yet. Emma wasn't an early riser, and Mark still tended toward the nocturnal. Julian was there, dishing up food, but he was wearing the pleasant, almost blank expression he always wore around strangers. Odd. She thought that she knew Julian well enough to realize that. They had a sort of bond, both of them loving Emma, but separated from each other by the knowledge Julian didn't realize she had. Julian trying to hide that he loved Emma, and Christina trying to hide that she knew. She wished she could offer him sympathy, but he would only recoil in horror. Christina. She nearly dropped her coffee. It was Diego. He looked awful. His face drawn, bags under his eyes, his hair tangled. He wore ordinary gear and seemed to have misplaced his Centaurian pin. She held up her hand.
Aléjate de mí, Diego.
Just listen to me.
Someone moved between them, the Spanish boy with the sandy hair, Manuel.
You heard her, he said in English. No one else was looking at them yet. They were all involved in their own conversations.
Leave her alone.
Christina turned and walked out of the room. She kept her back straight. She refused to hurry her steps, not for anyone. She was a Rosales. She didn't want the Centaurian's pity. She pushed through the front door and clattered down the stairs. She wished Emma was awake. They could go to the training room and kick and punch away their frustrations. She strode on unseeing until she nearly collided with the twisted quickbeam tree that still grew in the shabby grass in front of the Institute. It had been put there by fairies, a whipping tree used for punishment. It remained even when the punishment was over, when rain had washed Emma's blood from the grass and stones.
Christina, please.
She whirled. Diego was there, apparently having decided to ignore Manuel. He really did look awful, The shadows under his eyes looked as if they had been cut there. He had carried her across this grass, she remembered, only 2 weeks ago, when she had been injured. He had held her tightly, whispering her name over and over, and all the time he'd been engaged to someone else. She leaned back against the trunk of the tree. You really don't understand why I don't want to see you. Of course I understand it, he said. But it's not what you think.
Really? You're not engaged? You're not supposed to marry Zara?
She is my fiancée, he said. But, Christina, it's more complicated than it looks.
I really don't see how it could be.
I wrote to her, he said, after you and I got back together. I told her it was over.
I don't think she got your letter, Christina said.
Diego shoved his hands into his hair.
No, she did. She told me she read it, and that's why she came here. Honestly, I never thought she would. I thought it was over when I didn't hear from her.
I really thought I was free.
So you broke up with her last night?
He hesitated, and in that moment of hesitation, any thought that Christina had been harboring in the deepest recesses of her heart, any fleeting hope that this was all a mistake, vanished like mist burned away by the sun.
I didn't, he said. I can't.
But you just said you did in your letter.
Things are different now, he said. Christina, you'll have to trust me.
No, she said.
No, I won't. I already trusted you, despite the evidence of my own ears. I don't know if anything you said before was true. I don't know if the things you said about Jaime are true. Where is he?
Diego dropped his hands to his sides. He looked defeated.
There are things I cannot tell you. I wish you could believe me.
What's going on?
Zara's high, clear voice cut across the dry air. She was walking toward them, her centaurian pin gleaming in the sun. Diego glanced at her, a look of pain on his face.
I was talking to Christina.
I see that.
Zara's mouth was set into a little smile, a look that never seemed to leave her face. She swept a glance over Christina and put her hand on Diego's shoulder.
Come back inside, she said. We're figuring out what grids we're going to search today. You know this area well. Time to help out. Tick, tick.
She tapped her watch. Diego looked once at Christina, then turned back to his fiancée.
All right.
With a last superior glance, Zara slipped her hand into Diego's and half-dragged him back toward the Institute. Christina watched them go, the coffee she had drunk roiling in her stomach like acid. To Emma's disappointment, the Centaurians refused to allow any of the Blackthorns to accompany them on the search for Malcolm's body.
No thanks, said Zara, who appeared to have appointed herself unofficial head of the Centaurians. We've trained for this, and dealing with less experienced shadow hunters on this kind of mission is just distracting.
Emma glared at Diego, who was standing next to Zara. He looked away. They were gone almost all day, returning in time for dinner, which the Blackthorns wound up making. It was spaghetti, lots of spaghetti.
I miss the vampire pizza,
Emma muttered, glaring at an enormous bowl of red sauce. Julian snorted. He was standing over a pot of boiling water. The steam rose and curled his hair into damp ringlets.
Maybe they'll at least tell us if they found anything.
I doubt it, said Ty, who was preparing to set the table. It was an activity he'd enjoyed since he was little. He'd loved setting up each utensil in precise and even repeated order. Livy was helping him. Kit had skulked off and was nowhere to be found. He seemed to resent the intrusion of the Centaurians more than anyone else. Emma couldn't really blame him. He'd barely been adjusting to the Institute as it was when in swept these people whose needs he was expected to cater to. Ty was mostly right. Dinner was a large, lively affair. Zara had somehow managed to wedge herself in at the head of the table, ousting Diana, and gave them an abbreviated account of the day. Sections of ocean had been searched,
Nothing significant found, though trace elements of dark magic indicated a point farther out in the ocean where sea demons clustered.
"We'll approach it tomorrow," she said, elegantly forking up spaghetti.
"How are you searching?" Emma asked, her eagerness to know more about the advanced shadow-hunting techniques outweighing her dislike of Zara. After all, as Christina had said earlier, the situation wasn't really Zara's fault, it was Diego's. "Do you have any special gear?"
"Unfortunately, that information is proprietary to the Scholomance," Zara said with a cool smile,
even for someone who's supposed to be the best shadow hunter of her generation. Emma flushed and sat back in her chair.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"You know how people talk about you in Idris," said Zara. Her tone was careless, but her hazel eyes were dagger points.
"Like you're the new Jace Herondale."
"But we still have the old Jace Herondale," said Ty, puzzled.
"It's a saying," Julian said in a low voice. "It means, like, someone just as good."
Normally he would have said, "I'll draw it for you, Ty." Visual representations of sometimes confusing expressions like "he laughed his head off" or "the best thing since sliced bread" resulted in hilarious drawings by Julian, with explanatory notes about the real meaning of the expression underneath. The fact that he didn't say it made Emma look at him a little more sharply. His hackles were up because of the Centaurians, not that she blamed him. When Julian didn't trust someone, all his protective instincts kicked into gear to hide Livy's love of computers, Ty's unusual way of processing information, Drew's horror movies, Emma's rule-breaking. Julian raised his glass of water with a brilliantly artificial smile.
"Shouldn't all Nephilim information be shared?
We fight the same demons. If one branch of Nephilim has an advantage, isn't that unfair?"
"Not necessarily," said Samantha Larkspear, the female half of the twin Centaurians Emma had met the day before.
Her brother's name was Dane. They shared the same thin, whippety faces, pale skin, and straight dark hair.
"Not everyone has the training to use every tool, and a weapon you don't know how to wield is wasted."
"Everyone can learn," said Mark.
"Then perhaps one day you will attend the Scholomance and be trained," said the Centaurian from Mumbai. Her name was Divya Joshi.
"It's unlikely the Scholomance would accept someone with fairy blood," said Zara.
"The clave is hidebound," said Diego. "That is true."
"I dislike the word hidebound," said Zara.
"What they are is traditional. They seek to restore the separations between downworlders and shadow hunters that have always been in place. Mixing creates confusion."
"I mean, look what's happened with Alec Lightwood and Magnus Bane," said Samantha, waving her fork. "Everyone knows that Magnus uses his influence with the Lightwoods to get the Inquisitor to let downworlders off the hook, even for things like murder."
"Magnus would never do that," Emma said. She'd stopped eating, though she'd been starving when they'd sat down.
"And the Inquisitor doesn't try downworlders, only shadow hunters," said Julian. "Robert Lightwood couldn't let downworlders off the hook if he wanted to."
"Whatever," said Jessica Beauséjour,
a Centaurian with a faint French accent and rings on all her fingers.
"The Downworlder Shadow Hunter Alliance will be shut down soon enough."
"No one's shutting it down," said Christina. Her mouth was a tight line.
"That's a rumor."
"Speaking of rumors," said Samantha, "I heard Bane tricked Alec Lightwood into falling in love with him using a spell."
Her eyes glittered as if she couldn't decide if she found the idea appealing or disgusting.
"That's not true," said Emma, her heart beating fast. "That's a lie."
Manuel raised an eyebrow at her. Dane laughed.
"I wonder what'll happen when it wears off in that case," he said. "Bad news for downworlders if the Inquisitor's not so friendly."
Ty looked bewildered. Emma could hardly blame him. None of Zara's circle seemed to care about facts.
"Didn't you just hear Julian?" he said.
"The Inquisitor doesn't supervise cases where downworlders have broken the Accords. He doesn't—"
Livy put her hand on his wrist.
"We all support the Accords here," said Manuel, leaning back in his chair.
"The Accords were a fine idea," said Zara. But every tool needs sharpening. The Accords require refining. Warlocks should be regulated, for instance. They are too powerful and too independent. My father plans to suggest a registry of warlocks to the Council. Every warlock must give their information to the Clave and be tracked. If successful, it will be expanded to all downworlders. We can't have them running around without us being able to keep tabs on them. Look what happened with Malcolm Fade.
Sorry, you sound ridiculous, said John Cartwright, one of the older Centaurians, about 22, Emma would have guessed. Jace and Clary's age. The only thing Emma could remember about him was that he had a girlfriend, Marisol. Like an ancient council member, afraid of change.
Agreed, said Rayan. We're students and fighters, not lawmakers.
Whatever your father may be doing, it's not relevant to the Scholomance.
Zara looked indignant.
It's just a registry.
Am I the only one who's read X-Men and realizes why this is a bad idea? Said Kit.
Emma had no idea when he'd reappeared, but he had, and was idly twirling pasta on his fork. Zara began to frown, then brightened.
You're Kit Herondale, she said. The lost Herondale.
I didn't realize I was lost, said Kit. I never felt lost.
It must be exciting, suddenly finding you're a Herondale, Zara said.
Emma restrained the urge to point out that if you didn't know much about shadow hunters, finding out you were a Herondale was about as exciting as finding out you were a new species of snail.
I met Jace Herondale once.
She looked around expectantly.
Wow, said Kit. He really was a Herondale, Emma thought. He'd managed to insert Jace levels of indifference and sarcasm into one word.
I bet you can't wait to get to the Academy, said Zara. Since you're a Herondale, you'd certainly excel. I could put in a good word for you.
Kit was silent. Diana cleared her throat.
So what are your plans for tomorrow, Zara? Diego? Is there anything the Institute can do to assist you?
Now that you mention it, Zara said, it would be incredibly useful.
Everyone, even Kit, leaned forward with interest.
If while we were gone during the day, you did our laundry. Ocean water does ruin clothes quickly, don't you find?
Night fell with the suddenness of shadows in the desert. But despite the sound of waves coming in through her window, Christina couldn't sleep. Thoughts of home tore at her. Her mother, her cousins, better days with Diego and Jaime. She remembered a weekend she had spent with them once, tracking a demon in the dilapidated ghost town of Guerrero Viejo. The dreamlike landscape all around them, half-drowned houses, feathery weeds, buildings long discolored by water. She had lain on a rock with Jaime under uncountable stars, and they had told each other what they wanted most in the world. She, to end the cold peace, and he, to bring honor back to his family. Exasperated, she got out of bed and went downstairs, with only witch light to illuminate her steps. The stairs were dark and quiet, and she found her way out the back door of the Institute with little noise. Moonlight swept across the small dirt lot where the Institute's car was parked. Behind the lot was a garden where white marble classical statues poked incongruously out of the desert sand. Christina missed her mother's rose garden with a sudden intensity. The scent of the flowers, sweeter than desert sage, her mother walking between the orderly rows. Christina used to joke that her mother must have a warlock's help in keeping the flowers blooming, even during the hottest summer. She moved farther away from the house, toward the rows of holly-leaf cherry and alder trees. Drawing closer to them, she saw a shadow and froze, realizing that she had brought no weapons with her. Stupid, she thought. The desert was full of dangers, not all of them supernatural. Mountain lions didn't distinguish between mundanes and Nephilim. It wasn't a mountain lion. The shadow moved closer. She tensed, then relaxed. It was Mark. The moonlight turned his hair silvery white. His feet were bare under the hems of his jeans. Astonishment crossed his face as he saw her,
Then he walked up to her without hesitation and put her hand on her cheek.
"Am I imagining you?" he said.
"I was thinking about you, and now you are here." It was such a Mark thing to say, a frank statement of his emotions. Because fairies couldn't lie, she thought. He had grown up around them, and learned how to speak of love and loving with Kieran, who was proud and arrogant, but always truthful. Fairies did not associate truth with weakness and vulnerability, as humans did. It made Christina feel braver.
"I was thinking about you, too."
Mark feathered his thumb across her cheekbone. His palm was warm on her skin, cradling her head.
"What about me?
The look on your face when Zara and her friends were talking about downworlders during dinner? Your pain?" He laughed without humor.
"I should have expected it.
Had I been an active shadow hunter for the past 5 years, I would doubtless be more used to such talk.
Because of the cold piece?"
He nodded. When a decision like that is made by a government, it emboldens those who are already prejudiced to speak their deepest thoughts of hate. They assume they are simply brave enough to say what everyone really thinks.
"Mark,
in Zara's mind, I am hated," said Mark. His eyes were shadowed.
"I am sure her father is part of that group that demands Helen remain prisoned on Wrangell Island."
"She will come back," Christina said. "Now that you have come home and fought so loyally for the Shadowhunters, surely they will let her go." Mark shook his head, but all he said was,
"I'm sorry about Diego."
She reached up and put her hand over his. His fingers, light and cool as willow branches. She wanted to touch him more, abruptly, wanted to test the feel of his skin under his shirt, the texture of his jawline, where he had clearly never shaved and never needed to.
"No," she said. "No, you're not. Not really.
Are you?"
"Christina,"
Mark breathed, a little helplessly.
"Can I?"
Christina shook her head. If she actually let him ask, she'd never be able to say no.
"We can't," she said. "Emma."
"You know that's not real," Mark said. "I love Emma, but not like that."
"But it's important, what she's doing."
She drew away from Mark. "Julian has to believe it." He looked at her in puzzlement, and she remembered. Mark didn't know. Not about the curse. Not that Julian loved Emma, or that Emma loved him.
"Everyone has to believe it. And besides," she added hastily, "there's Kieran. You only just ended things with him. And I just ended things with Diego."
He only looked more puzzled. She supposed fairies had never adopted the human ideas of giving each other space and having time to get over relationships. And maybe they were stupid ideas. Maybe love was love, and you should take it when you found it. Certainly her body was screaming at her mind to shut up.
She wanted to put her arms around Mark. Wanted to hold him as he held her, feel his chest against hers as his expanded with breath.
Something echoed out in the darkness. It sounded like the snap of an enormous branch followed by a slow, dragging noise. Christina whirled, reaching for her balisong, but it was inside, on her nightstand.
"Do you think it's the Centaurians' night patrol?" she whispered to Mark.
He was looking out into the darkness, too, narrow-eyed.
"No, that was not a human noise."
He took out 2 seraph blades and pressed 1 into her hand.
"Nor was it an animal."
The weight of the blade in Christina's hand was familiar and comforting. After a moment's pause to apply a night vision rune, she followed Mark into the desert shadows. Kit opened his bedroom door a crack and peered through. The hallway was deserted. No Ty sitting outside his door, reading or lying on the floor with headphones on. No lights seeping from underneath other doors. just the dim glow of the rows of white lights that ran across the ceiling. He half expected alarms to go off as he crept through the silent house and opened the front door of the Institute, some kind of shrieking whistle or burst of lights. But there was nothing, just the sound of an ordinary heavy door creaking open and shut behind him. He was outside, on the porch above the steps that led toward the trampled grass in front of the Institute, and then the road to the highway. The view over the cliff and down to the sea was bathed in moonlight, silver and black, a white path slashing across the water. It was beautiful here, Kit thought, slinging his duffel bag over his shoulder, but not beautiful enough to stay. You couldn't trade a beach view for freedom. He started down the stairs. His foot hit the first step and went out from under him as he was yanked backward. His duffel bag went flying. A hand was gripping his shoulder hard. Kit wrenched himself sideways, nearly falling down the steps, and flung out his arm, colliding with something solid. He heard a muffled grunt. There was a barely visible figure, just a shadow among the shadows, looming over him, blocking the moon. A second later, they were both falling, Kit thudding to the porch on his back, a dark shadow collapsing on top of him. He felt sharp knees and elbows poke into him, and a moment later, a light flared, one of those stupid little stones they call witch lights. Kit, said a voice above him, Tiberius's voice. Stop thrashing. Ty shook his dark hair out of his face. He was kneeling over Kit, sitting on his solar plexus pretty much, which made it hard to breathe, dressed all in black the way shadow hunters did when they went out to fight. Only his hands and face were bare, very white in the darkness.
Were you running away? He said.
I was going for a walk, said Kit.
No, you're lying, said Ty, eyeing Kit's duffel bag. You were running away. Kit sighed and let his head fall back with a thump.
Why do you care what I do?
I'm a shadow hunter. We help people. Now you're lying, said Kit, with conviction. Ty smiled. It was a genuine light-up-your-face type smile, and it made Kit remember the first time he'd met Ty. Ty hadn't been sitting on him then, but he had been holding a dagger to Kit's throat. Kit had looked at him and forgotten the knife and thought, beautiful. Beautiful like all the shadow hunters were beautiful. Like moonlight shearing off the edges of broken glass, lovely and deadly. Beautiful things. Cruel things. Cruel in that way that only people who absolutely believed in the rightness of their cause could be cruel. I need you, Ty said. You might be surprised to hear that.
I am, Kit agreed. He wondered if anyone was going to come running. He couldn't hear approaching feet or voices.
What happened to the night patrol? He demanded.
They're probably half a mile from here, said Ty.
They're trying to keep demons from getting near the Institute, not keep you from getting out. Now, do you want to know what I need you for, or not? Almost against his will, Kit was curious. He propped himself up on his elbows and nodded. Ty was sitting on him as casually as if Kit was a sofa, but his fingers, long, quick fingers, deft with a knife, Kit recalled, hovered near his weapons belt. You're a criminal, Ty said. Your father was a con man, and you wanted to be like him. Your duffel bag is probably full of things you stole from the Institute.
It, Kit began, and trailed off as Ty reached over, yanked the zipper on the bag down, and eyed the cache of stolen daggers, boxes, scabbards, candlesticks, and anything else Kit had scavenged, revealed in the moonlight.
Might be, Kit concluded. What's that got to do with you anyway? None of it's yours.
I want to solve crimes, Ty said. To be a detective. But nobody here cares about that sort of thing.
Didn't you just all catch a murderer?
Malcolm sent a note, Ty said in a withering tone, as if he were disappointed that Malcolm had ruined crime-solving with his confession, and then he admitted he did it.
That does rather narrow down the list of suspects, Kit said. Look, if you need me so you can arrest me for fun, I feel I should point out it's the sort of thing you can only do once.
I don't want to arrest you. I want a partner. Someone who knows about crimes and people who commit them so they can help me.
A light bulb went off in Kit's head.
You want to... Wait. You've been sleeping outside my room because you want a sort of Watson for your Sherlock Holmes? Ty's eyes lit up. They still moved restlessly around Kit, as if he were reading him, examining him, never quite meeting Kit's own, but that didn't dim their glow.
You know about them?
Everyone in the world knows about them, Kit almost said, but instead only said,
I'm not going to be anyone's Watson. I don't want to solve crimes. I don't care about crimes. I don't care if they're being committed or not committed.
Don't think of them as crimes. Think of them as mysteries. Besides, what else are you going to do? Run away and go where?
I don't care.
You do, though, said Ty. You want to live, just like everyone else does. You don't want to be trapped, is all. He cocked his head to the side, his eyes a depthless, almost white, in the witchlight glow. The moon had gone behind a cloud, and it was the only illumination. How do you know I was going to run away tonight?
Because you were getting used to it here, said Ty. You were getting used to us.
But the Centaurians, you don't like them. Livy noticed it first. And after what Zara said today about you going to the academy, you must feel like you're not going to have any choices about what you do after this.
It was true, surprisingly so. Kit couldn't find the words to explain how he'd felt at the dinner table, as if becoming a shadow hunter meant being shoved into a machine that would chew him up and spit out a Centaurian.
I look at them, he said, and I think, I can't possibly be like them, and they can't stand anyone different.
You don't have to go to the academy, said Ty. You can stay with us as long as you want.
Kit doubted Ty had the authority to make a promise like that, but he appreciated it regardless.
As long as I help you solve mysteries, he said. How often do you have mysteries to solve? Or do I have to wait until another warlock goes crazy pants?
Ty leaned against one of the pillars, his hands fluttered at his sides like night butterflies. Actually, there's a mystery going on right now.
Kit was intrigued, despite himself.
What is it?
I think they're not here for the reason they claim they are. I think they're up to something, Ty said. And they're definitely lying to us.
Who's lying?
Ty's eyes sparkled.
The Centaurians, of course.
The next day was blistering hot. One of those rare days when the air seemed to stand still and the proximity of the ocean offered no relief. When Emma arrived late for breakfast in the dining room, the rarely used ceiling fans were whirling full speed.
Was it a sand demon?
Dane Larkspear was asking Christina.
Akvan and Iblis demons are common in the desert.
We know that, said Julian.
Mark already said it was a sea demon.
It slithered off the moment we shone the witchlight upon it, said Mark. But it left behind the stink of seawater and wet sand.
I can't believe there aren't perimeter wards here, Zara said. Why has no one ever seen to it?
I ought to ask Mr. Blackthorne.
The perimeter wards failed to keep out Sebastian Morgenstern, said Diana. They weren't used again after that. Perimeter wards rarely work.
She sounded as if she were struggling to keep her temper. Emma couldn't blame her. Zara looked at her with a sort of superior pity.
Well, with all those sea demons crawling up out of the ocean, which they wouldn't be doing if Malcolm Fade's body wasn't in there, you know, I think they're called for, don't you?
There was a murmur of voices. Most of the Centaurians, except for Diego, John, and Rayan, seemed to be in agreement. As they made plans to set the wards up that morning, Emma tried to catch Julian's eye to share his annoyance, but he was looking away from her, toward Mark and Christina.
What were you two doing outside last night, anyway?
We couldn't sleep, Mark said. We bumped into each other.
Zara smiled.
Of course you did. She turned to whisper something into Samantha's ear. Both girls giggled.
Christina blushed angrily. Emma saw Julian's hand tighten on his fork. He laid it down slowly next to his plate.
Emma bit her lip. If Mark and Christina wanted to date, she'd give them her blessing. She'd stage some kind of breakup with Mark. Their relationship had already done a lot of what it needed to do. Julian could barely look at her anymore, and that was what she'd wanted, wasn't it? He didn't seem happy about the idea that she and Mark might be over, though, not even a little bit, if he was even thinking about that. There had been a time when she could always tell what Julian had on his mind. Now she could only read the surface of his thoughts. His deeper feelings were hidden. Diego looked from Mark to Christina and stood up, shoving back his chair. He walked out of the room. After a moment, Emma dropped her napkin onto her plate and followed. He had stomped all the way to the back door and out into the parking lot before he noticed she was following him, a sure sign he was upset, given Diego's level of training. He turned to face her, his dark eyes glittering. "Emma," he said, "I understand you wish to scold me. You have for days, but this is not a good time." "And what would be a good time? You want to pencil it into your day planner under never going to happen?" She raised an eyebrow. "That's what I thought. Come on." She stalked around the side of the institute, Diego reluctantly following. They reached a spot where a small mound of dirt rose between cacti, familiar to Emma from long experience. "You stand there," she said, pointing. He gave her a disbelieving look. "So we won't be seen from the windows," she explained, and he grouchily did as she'd asked, crossing his arms across his muscular chest. "Emma," he said, "you do not and cannot understand, and I cannot explain it to you." "I bet you can't," she said. "Look, you know I haven't always been your biggest fan, but I thought a lot better of you than this." A muscle twitched in his face. His jaw was rigid. "As I said, you cannot understand, and I cannot explain." "It would be one thing," Emma said, "if you'd just been two-timing, which I would still think was despicable, but Zara? You're the reason she's here. You know we aren't. You know Julian has to be careful."
"He should not worry too much," said Diego tonelessly. "Zara is only interested in what profits her. I do not think she has any interest in Arthur's secrets. Only in getting attention from the council for completing this mission successfully."
"Easy for you to assume."
"I have reasons for everything I do, Emma," he said.
"Maybe Christina does not know them now, but one day she will."
"Diego, everyone has reasons for everything they do. Malcolm had reasons for what he did."
Diego's mouth flattened into a thin line.
"Do not compare me to Malcolm Fade."
"Because he was a warlock?" Emma's voice was low, dangerous. "Because you think like your fiancé does, about the cold peace, about warlocks and fairies, about Mark?"
"Because he was a murderer," Diego spoke through his teeth. "Whatever else you think of me, Emma, I am not a senseless bigot. I do not believe downworlders are lesser, to be registered or to be tortured."
"But you admit Zara does," said Emma.
"I have never told her anything," he said.
"Maybe you can understand why I'm wondering how you could prefer her to Christina," Emma said.
Diego tensed and shouted.
Emma had forgotten how fast he could move, despite his bulk. He leapt back, cursing, and kicked out with his left foot. Muttering in pain, he kicked off his shoe. Columns of ants marched over his ankle, scurrying up his leg.
"Oh, dear," said Emma. "You must have stood on a red anthill, you know, accidentally."
Diego slapped the ants away, still cursing. He'd kicked away part of the top of the mound of dirt, and ants were pouring out of it. Emma stepped back.
"Don't worry," she said. "They're not poisonous."
"You tricked me into standing on an anthill." He shoved his foot back into his shoe, but Emma knew he'd have itchy bites for a few days, unless he used an Arazi.
"Christina made me promise not to touch you, so I had to get creative," Emma said.
"You shouldn't have lied to my best friend, disgraciado mentiroso." He stared at her. Emma sighed.
"I hope that meant what I think it meant. I'd hate to have called you a rusty bucket or something."
"No," he said. To her surprise, he sounded wearily amused.
"It meant what you thought it meant."
"Good." She stalked back toward the house. She was almost out of earshot when he called after her. She turned and saw him standing where she'd left him, apparently heedless of the ants or the hot sun beating down on his shoulders. "Believe me, Emma,
he said loudly enough for her to hear him. No one hates me more than I hate myself right now.
Do you really think so?
She asked. Emma didn't shout, but she knew the words carried. He looked at her for a long moment, silently, before she walked away. The day stayed hot until the late afternoon, when a storm rolled in over the ocean. The Centaurians had left before noon, and Emma couldn't help but stare out the windows anxiously as the sun set behind a mass of black and gray clouds on the horizon, shot through with heat lightning.
"Do you think they'll be okay?"
Drew asked, her hands worrying the hilt of her throwing knife.
"Aren't they in a boat? Looks like a bad storm."
"We don't know what they're doing," Emma said. She almost added that thanks to the Centaurians' snobbish desire to conceal their activities from the Institute's shadow hunters, it would be very difficult to rescue them if something dangerous did happen. But she saw the look on Drew's face and didn't. Drew had practically hero-worshipped Diego, despite everything. She was probably still fond of him. Emma felt briefly guilty about the ants.
"They'll be fine," said Christina, reassuringly. "Centaurians are very careful."
Livy called Drew over to the fence with her, and Drew trailed off toward where Ty, Kit, and Livy stood together on a training mat. Somehow Kit had been convinced to don training gear. He looked like a mini Jace, Emma thought with amusement, with his blonde curls and angular cheekbones. Behind them, Diana was showing Mark a training stance. Emma blinked. Julian had been there a moment ago, she was sure of it.
"He went in to check on your uncle," Christina said. "Something about him not liking storms."
"No, it's Tavi who doesn't like..."
Emma's voice trailed off.
Tavi was sitting in the corner of the training room, reading a book. She remembered all the times Julian had disappeared during storms, claiming Tavi was frightened of them. She slid Cortana into its sheath. "I'll be back." Christina watched her go with troubled eyes. No one else seemed to notice as she slipped out the training room door and down the hallway. The massive windows spaced along the corridor let in a peculiar gray light, hazed with pinpoints of silver. She reached the door to the attic and ran up the stairs. Though she didn't bother to conceal the sound of her footfalls, neither Arthur nor Julian seemed to have noticed her when she entered the main attic room. The windows were tightly closed and sealed with paper, all except one, over the desk at which Arthur sat. The paper had been torn away from it, showing clouds racing across the sky, colliding and untangling like thick rounds of gray and black yarn. Trays of uneaten food were scattered on Arthur's several desks. The room smelled like rot and mildew. Emma swallowed, wondering if she'd made a mistake in coming. Arthur was slumped in his desk chair, blank hair falling over his eyes.
"I want them to go," he was saying. "I don't like having them here."
"I know," Julian spoke with a gentleness that surprised Emma. How could he not be angry? She was angry. Angry about everything that had conspired to force Julian to grow up too fast, that had deprived him of a childhood. How could he look at Arthur and not think of that? "I want them to go, too. But there's nothing I can do to send them away. We have to be patient."
"I need my medicine,"
Arthur whispered.
"Where is Malcolm?"
Emma winced at the look on Julian's face, and Arthur seemed suddenly to notice her. He raised his eyes, their gaze fixing on her. No, not on her. On her sword.
"Cortana," he said. "Made by Waylon the Smith, the legendary forger of Excalibur and Dorindor, said to choose its bearer. When Orgier raised it to slay the son of Charlemagne on the field, an angel came and broke the sword and said to him, 'Mercy is better than revenge.'"
Emma looked at Julian. It was shadowy in the attic, but she could see his hands clenched at his sides. Was he angry at her for following him? "But Cortana has never been broken," she said.
"It's only a story," Julian said.
"There is truth in stories,"
said Arthur.
There is truth in one of your paintings, boy. Or in a sunset. Or a couplet from Homer. Fiction is truth, even if it is not fact. If you believe only in facts and forget stories, your brain will live, but your heart will die.
I understand, Uncle. Julian sounded tired. I'll be back later. Please eat something, all right?
Arthur lowered his face into his hands, shaking his head. Julian began to move across the room to the stairs. Halfway there, he caught Emma's wrist, drawing her after him. He exerted no real force, but she followed him anyway, shocked into compliance simply by the physical sensation of his hand on her wrist. He only touched her to apply runes these days. She missed those friendly touches she was used to from the years of their friendship. A hand brushing her arm, a tap on her shoulder, their secret way of communicating, fingers drawing words and letters on each other's skin, silent and invisible to everyone else. It seemed like forever. And now sparks were racing up her arm from that one point of contact, making her body feel hot, stinging, and confused. His fingers looped her wrist as they went out the front door. When it closed behind them, he let go, turning to face her. The air felt heavy and dense, pressing against Emma's skin. Mist obscured the highway. She could see the heaving surface of gray waves slapping against the shore. From here, each looked as big as a humpback whale. She could see the moon struggling to show itself between clouds. Julian was breathing hard as if he'd been running flat out for miles. The dampness of the air stuck his shirt to his chest as he leaned back against the wall of the Institute.
"Why did you come to the attic?" he said.
"I'm sorry," she spoke stiffly. She hated being stiff around Jules. They'd rarely had a fight that didn't end in a casual apology or joking.
"I had this feeling that you needed me, and I could not come.
I understand if you're angry."
"I'm not angry."
Lightning sizzled out over the water, briefly whitening the sky.
"That's the hell of it. I can't be angry, can I?
Mark doesn't know a thing about you and me. He isn't trying to hurt me. None of it's his fault. And you did the right thing. I can't hate you for that." He pushed off the wall, took a restless few paces. The energy of the pent-up storm seemed to crackle off his skin.
"But I can't stand it. What do I do, Emma?"
He raked his hands through his hair. The humidity was making it curl into ringlets that clung to his fingers.
"We can't live like this."
"I know," she said. "I'll go away. It's only a few months. I'll be 18. We'll take our travel years away from each other. We'll forget."
"Will we?"
His mouth twisted into an impossible smile.
"We have to." Emma began to shiver. It was cold, the clouds above them roiling like the smoke of a scorched sky.
"I should never have touched you," he said. He'd drawn closer to her, or maybe she'd move closer to him, wanting to take his hands, the way she always had.
"I never thought what we had could break so easily." "It's not broken," she whispered. "We made a mistake, but being together wasn't the mistake."
"Most people get to make mistakes, Emma. It doesn't have to ruin their whole lives." She closed her eyes, but she could still see him, still feel him, inches away from her, the heat of his body, the scent of cloves that clung to his clothes and hair. It was making her insane, making her knees shake as if she just staggered off a roller coaster.
"Our lives aren't ruined."
His arms went around her. She thought for a moment of resisting, but she was so tired of fighting what she wanted. She hadn't thought she'd ever get this. Jules in her arms again, all lean muscle and taut tension, strong painter's hands smoothing down her back, his fingers tracing letters, words on her skin.
"I am. R-U-I-N-E-D. She opened her eyes, appalled. His face was so close, it was almost a blur of light and shadow. Emma, he said, his arms leashing her, pulling her closer. And then he was kissing her. They were kissing each other. He drew her against him. He fit his body to hers, curves and hollows, muscles and softness. His mouth was open over hers, his tongue running gently along the seam of her lips. Thunder exploded around them, lightning shattering across the mountains, blazing a path of dry heat across the inside of Emma's eyelids. She opened her mouth under his, pressing up against him, her arms wrapping around his neck. He tasted like fire, like spice. He ran his hands down her sides, over her hips, drew her more firmly against him. He was making a low sound in his throat, sort of anguished, wanting sound. It felt like forever. It felt like no time at all. His hands molded the shape of her shoulder blades, the curve of her body beneath her rib cage, thumbs arching over the crests of her hips. He lifted her up and against him, as if they could fit into each other's empty spaces, as words spilled from his mouth, frantic, hurried. Emma, I need you. Always, always think about you. I was wishing you were with me in that goddamn attic. And then I turn around, and you were there, like you heard me. Like you're always there when I need you.
Lightning forked again, illuminating the world. Emma could see her hands on Julian's shirt hem. What the hell was she thinking? Was she planning for them both to strip down on the Institute's front porch? Reality reasserted itself. She pushed away, her heart slamming against her chest.
Em?
He looked at her, dazed, his eyes sleepy and hot and wanting. It made her swallow hard, but his words echoed in her head. He'd wanted her, and she'd come as if she'd heard him call. She'd felt that wanting, known it, not been able to stop herself. All these weeks of insisting to herself that the parabatite bond was weakening, and now he was telling her they'd practically just read each other's minds.
Mark, she said.
And it was just one word, but it was the word, the most brutal reminder of their situation. The sleepy look left his eyes. He whitened, aghast. He raised his hand as if he meant to say something, explain, apologize, and the sky seemed to rip down the middle. They both turned to stare as the clouds directly above them parted. A shadow grew in the air, darkening as it neared them. The figure of a man, massive and bound in armor, bareback on a red-eyed, foaming horse, black and gray, like the storm clouds overhead. Julian moved as if to thrust Emma behind him, but she wouldn't budge. She simply stared as the horse came to a neighing, pawing stop at the foot of the Institute steps. A man looked up at them. His eyes, like Mark's, were two different colors, in his case, blue and black. His face was terrifyingly familiar. It was Gwyn Ap Nudd, the lord and leader of the Wild Hunt. And he did not look pleased. Chapter 7. Seas Without a Shore. Before Julian or Emma could speak, the front door of the Institute slammed open. Diana was there, with Mark just behind her, still in his training clothes. Diana, in a white suit, looked as beautiful and formidable as always. Gwyn's towering, brindled horse reared as Mark approached the top of the steps. Catching sight of Emma and Jules as they strode toward him, Mark looked more than a little surprised. Emma's cheeks felt as if they must be burning, though when she looked at Julian, he seemed unruffled, cool as always. They joined Mark just as Diana swept to the top of the steps. The foreshadow hunter stared down at the hunter. His horse's eyes were blood red, and so was the armor that Gwyn wore. Tough, crimson leather, torn here and there by claw marks and the rips made by weapons.
Because of the cold peace, I cannot bid you welcome, Diana said. Why are you here, Gwyn Hunter?
Gwyn's ancient gaze glided up and down Diana. There was no malice in it or arrogance, only the fairy appreciation for something beautiful.
"Lovely lady," he said. "I do not think we have met."
Diana looked momentarily nonplussed. "Diana Rayburn, I'm the tutor here."
"Those who teach are honored in the land under the hill," said Gwyn.
Under his arm he carried a massive helmet decorated with a stag's antlers. His hunting horn lay across the pommel of his saddle. Emma boggled. Was Gwyn hitting on Diana? She didn't know fairies did that exactly. She heard Mark make an exasperated noise. "Gwyn," he said, "I give you fair greetings. My heart is gladdened to see you." Emma couldn't help wondering if any of that was true. She knew Mark had complicated feelings for Gwyn. He'd spoken of them sometimes during the nights in her room, head on his hand. She had a clearer picture of the Wild Hunt now than she'd ever had before, of its delights and horrors, of the strange path Mark had been forced to make for himself between the stars.
"I would that I could say the same," said Gwyn. "I bring dark news from the Unseelie Court. Kieran of your heart."
"He's not of my heart any longer," interrupted Mark. It was a fairy expression, "of my heart," the closest they might come to saying girlfriend or boyfriend.
"Kieran Hunter has been found guilty of the murder of Irloth," said Gwyn. "He stood trial at the court of the Unseelie, though it was a short affair."
Mark flushed, tensing all over. "And the sentence?"
"Death," said Gwyn. "He will die at the moon's rise, tomorrow night if there's no intervention."
Mark didn't move. Emma wondered if she should do something, move closer to Mark, offer comfort, a gentling hand. But the expression on his face was unreadable. If it was grief, she didn't recognize it. If it was anger, then it was unlike any anger he had shown before. "That is sad news," Mark said finally. It was Julian who moved then, stepping to his brother's side. Julian put a hand on Mark's shoulder.
Emma felt relief flood through her.
"Is that all?" Gwyn said. "Have you nothing else to say?"
Mark shook his head. He looked fragile, Emma thought worriedly, as if you could see through his skin to the bones underneath. "Kieran betrayed me," he said. "He is nothing to me now." Gwyn looked at Mark in disbelief.
"He loved you, and he lost you, and he tried to get you back," he said. "He wanted you to ride with the hunt again. So did I. You were one of our best. Is that so terrible?"
"You saw what happened." Mark did sound angry now, and Emma herself could not help but remember the twisted quickbeam tree she had leaned against while Irloth whipped Julian, and then her and Kieran and Mark and Gwyn watched. The pain and the blood, the lashes like fire against her skin, though nothing had hurt as much as watching Julian be hurt. "Irloth whipped my family, my friend, because of Kieran. He whipped Emma and Julian."
"And now you have given up the hunt for them," said Gwyn, his two colored eyes flicking toward Emma. "And so, there is your vengeance, if you wanted it. But where is your compassion?"
"What do you want of my brother?" Julian demanded, his hand still on Mark's shoulder. "Do you want him to grieve visibly for your amusement? Is that why you came?"
"Mortals," Gwyn said. "You think you know so much, yet you know so little."
His large hand tightened on his helmet. "I do not want you to grieve for Kieran.
I want you to rescue him, Mark Hunter."
Thunder rumbled in the distance, but in front of the Institute there was only silence, profound as a shout. Even Diana seemed struck speechless. In the quiet, Emma could hear the sounds of Livy and the others up in the training room, their voices and laughter. Jules' expression was flat, calculating. His hand on Mark's shoulder was a tight grip now.
"I want you to rescue him, Mark Hunter."
Anger swelled quickly inside Emma,
Unlike Jules, she didn't bite it back.
"Mark is not of the Wild Hunt any longer," she said hotly. "Don't call him Hunter. He isn't one."
"He is a shadow hunter, isn't he?" asked Gwyn. Now that he had made his bizarre request, he seemed more relaxed. "Once a hunter, always a hunter of some sort."
"And now, you wish me to hunt for Kieran?"
Mark spoke in a strange, halting tone, as if he were having difficulty getting the words out past his anger.
"Why me, Gwyn? Why not you? Why not any of you?"
"Did you not hear me?" said Gwyn. "He is held captive by his father, the Unseelie King himself, in the depths of the court."
"And is Mark indestructible, then? You think he can take on the Unseelie court where the Wild Hunt can't?"
It was Diana. She had moved down a step, and her dark hair blew in the desert wind.
"Yours is a famous name, Gwyn ap Nudd. You have ridden with the Wild Hunt for hundreds of mortal years. There are many stories about you. Yet never have I heard that the leader of the Wild Hunt had succumbed to madness."
"The Wild Hunt is not subject to the rule of the courts," said Gwyn. "But we fear them. It would be madness not to. When they came to take Kieran, I and all my hunters were forced to swear a life oath that we would not challenge the trial or its outcome. To attempt to rescue Kieran now would mean death for us."
"That's why you've come to me. Because I didn't swear. Because even if I did, I can lie.
A lying thief, that's what you want," Mark said.
"What I wanted was one I could trust," said Gwyn.
"One who was not sworn. One who would dare the court."
"We want no trouble with you."
It was Julian, keeping his voice level, with an effort that Emma suspected only she could sense.
"But you must see that Mark cannot do what you are asking. It is too dangerous."
"We of the folk of the air do not fear danger, nor death," said Gwyn.
"If you don't fear death," said Julian, "then let Kieran meet it."
Gwyn recoiled at the coldness in Julian's voice.
"Kieran is not yet 20.
"Neither is Mark," said Julian. "If you think we're afraid of you, you're right. We'd be fools not to be. I know who you are, Gwyn. I know you once made a man eat his own father's heart. I know you took the hunt from Hearn in a battle over Cadar Idris. I know things that would surprise you. But I am Mark's brother, and I will not let him risk himself in Faerie again."
"The Wild Hunt is a brotherhood as well," Gwyn said. "If you cannot bring yourself to help Kieran out of love, Mark, do it out of friendship."
"Enough," Diana snapped. "We respect you here, Gwyn the Hunter, but this discussion is at an end. Mark will not be taken from us."
Gwyn's voice was a bass rumble.
"What if he chooses to go?"
They all looked at Mark. Even Julian turned, dropping his hand slowly from Mark's shoulder. Emma saw the fear in his eyes. She imagined it was echoed in her own. If Mark still loved Kieran, even a little bit.
"I do not choose it," said Mark. "I do not choose it, Gwyn."
Gwyn's face tightened.
"You have no honor."
Light speared through gaps in the clouds overhead. The storm was moving toward the mountains. The gray illumination cast a film across Mark's eyes, rendering them unreadable.
"I thought you were my friend,"
he said, and then he turned and stumbled back into the institute, the door slamming shut behind him. Gwyn began to dismount, but Diana raised her hand, palm out.
"You know you cannot enter the institute," she said.
Gwyn subsided. For a moment, as he gazed at Diana, his face looked lined and old, though Emma knew he was ageless.
"Kieran is not yet 20, he said again. "Only a boy."
Diana's face softened. But before she could speak, Gwyn's horse reared up. Something flew from Gwyn's hand and landed on the step below Diana's feet. Gwyn leaned forward and his horse exploded into motion, its mane and tail blurring into a single white flame. The flame shot toward the sky and vanished, disappearing into the night's fretwork of clouds. Julian shouldered the door of the institute open. Mark? Mark! The empty foyer swung around him as he turned. Fear for his brother was like pressure on his skin, tightening his veins, slowing his blood. It wasn't a fear he could put a name to. Gwen was gone. Mark was safe. It had been a request, not a kidnapping.
Jules?
Mark appeared from the closet beneath the staircase, clearly having just hung up his jacket. His blonde hair was tousled, his expression puzzled.
Did he leave?
He's gone. It was Emma who would come in behind Julian. Diana, a step after her, was closing the front door. Mark went straight across the room to Emma without a pause and put his arms around her. The jealousy that flared through Julian took his breath away. He thought he had gotten used to seeing Emma and Mark like this. They weren't a particularly demonstrative couple. They didn't kiss or cuddle in front of other people. Emma wouldn't, Julian thought. She wasn't like that. She was determined, and she was matter of fact, and she would do what needed to be done, but she wasn't cruel. It was Mark who reached for her, usually. For the small, quiet things. The hand on the shoulder, the brushing away of a stray eyelash, a quick embrace. There was an exquisite pain in watching that, more than there would have been in seeing them passionately embracing. After all, when you were dying of thirst, it was the sip of water you dreamed about, not the whole reservoir. But now, the feel of holding Emma was so close, the taste of her still on his mouth, her rose water scent on his clothes. He would play back the scene of their kiss over and over in his head, he knew, until it faded and fragmented and came apart like a photograph folded and unfolded too many times. But it was too close now, like a just-delivered wound. And seeing Emma in Mark's arms was a sharp splash of acid on raw skin, a brutal reminder. He couldn't afford to be sentimental, or to think of her as possibly his, even in an imaginary someday. To consider possibilities was to open yourself up to pain. Reality had to be his focus. Reality. And his responsibilities to his family. Otherwise he would go insane.
Do you think he'll come back?
Emma drew back from Mark. Julian thought she cast him an anxious, sideways glance, but he wasn't sure. There was no point wondering. He crushed his curiosity down brutally.
Gwyn?
Said Mark. No, I refused him. He won't beg and he won't return.
Are you sure?
Julian said. Mark gave him a wry look.
Do not let Gwyn fool you, he said. If I do not help him, he will find someone else to do it, or he will do it himself. Kieran will come to no harm.
Emma made a relieved noise. Julian said nothing. He was wondering about Kieran himself. He remembered how the fairy boy had gotten Emma whipped bloody and broken Mark's heart. He remembered also how Kieran had helped him defeat Malcolm. Without him, they would have had no chance. And he remembered what Kieran had said to him before the battle with Malcolm.
You are not gentle. You have a ruthless heart.
If he could have saved Kieran by risking his own safety, he would have. But he would not risk his brother. If that made him ruthless, so be it. If Mark was right, Kieran would be fine anyway.
Diana, said Emma.
Their tutor was leaning against the closed front door, looking down at her palm.
What did Gwen throw at you?
Diana held out her hand. Glimmering on her brown skin was a small golden acorn. Mark looked surprised.
That is a fair gift, he said. Should you crack open that acorn, Gwen would be summoned to aid you.
Why would he give Diana something like that? Asked Emma. The ghost of a smile touched Mark's mouth as he began to mount the stairs.
He admired her, he said. It is rare I have seen Gwyn admire a woman before. I had thought perhaps his heart was closed to that sort of thing.
Gwyn has a crush on Diana? Emma inquired, her dark eyes brightening.
I mean, not that you're not very attractive, Diana. It just seems sudden.
Fairies are like that, said Julian. He almost felt for Diana. He had never seen her look so rattled. She was worrying at her lower lip with her teeth, and Julian remembered that Diana really wasn't very old, only 28 or so. Not that much older than Jace and Clary.
"It doesn't mean anything," she said. "And besides, we have more important things to think about."
She dropped the acorn into Mark's hand just as the front door flew open and the Centaurians poured in. They looked wind-tossed and soaking wet, every one of them drenched. Diana, seeming relieved to no longer be talking about her love life, went off to find blankets and towels. Drying runes notoriously worked well to dry your skin, but didn't do much for your clothes.
"Did you find anything?" Emma asked. "I think we've located the likely spot where the body sank," said Manuel.
"But the sea was too rough for us to dive for it. We'll have to try again tomorrow."
"Manuel," Zara said warningly, as if he'd revealed the secret passcode that would open the gates to hell under their feet.
Manuel and Rayan rolled their eyes. "It's not like they don't know what we're looking for, Zara."
"The Scholomancer's methods are secret."
Zara thrust her damp jacket into Diego's arms and turned back to Emma and Julian.
"Right," she said. "What's for dinner?"
"I can't tell any of them apart," said Kit. "It's the uniforms. It makes them all look the same to me, like ants."
"Ants don't all look the same," said Ty.
They were sitting at the edge of the second-floor gallery, overlooking the main institute entryway below. Wet Centaurians scurried to and fro. Kit saw Julian and Emma, along with Diana, trying to make conversation with the ones who hadn't wandered off to the dining room and the fireplace there to get warm.
"Who is everyone again?" said Kit. "And where are they from?"
"Dane and Samantha Larkspear," said Livy, indicating two dark-haired Centaurians.
"Atlanta."
"Twins," said Ty.
"How dare they," said Livy with a grin. Kit had been worried she wouldn't be thrilled with Ty's plan to absorb Kit into his detecting plans, but she'd just given a wry smile when they'd come over to her in the training room and said,
"Welcome to the club."
Livy pointed.
"Manuel Casales Villalobos, from Madrid. Rayan Maduabachi, Lagos Institute. Divya Joshi, Mumbai Institute. Not everyone's connected with an institute, though. Diego's not. Zara isn't, or her friend Jessica, who's French, I think. And there's John Cartwright and Jen Whitelaw and Thomas Aldertree, all Academy graduates." She tilted her head. "And not one of them has the sense to come in out of the rain."
"Tell me again why you think they're all up to something," Kit said.
"All right," said Ty.
Kit had noticed already that Ty responded directly to what you said to him, and much less so to tone or intonation. Not that he couldn't use a refresher on why they were halfway up a building staring at a bunch of jerks.
"I was sitting in front of your room this morning when I saw Zara go into Diana's office. When I followed her, I saw she was going through papers there."
"She could have had a reason," said Kit.
"To be sneaking through Diana's papers? What reason?" said Livy, so firmly that Kit had to admit that if it looked scurrilous, it probably was scurrilous.
"I texted Simon Lewis about Cartwright, Whitelaw, and Aldertree," said Livy, resting her chin on the lower crossbar of the railing. "He says Jen and Thomas are solid, and Cartwright is kind of a lunk, but basically harmless."
"They might not all be involved," said Ty. "We have to figure out which of them are and what they want."
"What's a lunk?" said Kit.
"Sort of a combination of hunk and lump, I think, as in large but not that smart."
Livy grinned her quick grin as a shadow rose up over them. Christina, her hands on her hips, her eyebrows quirked.
"What are you three doing?" she asked.
Kit had a healthy respect for Christina Rosales. Sweet as she looked, he'd seen her throw a balisong 50 feet and hit her target exactly.
"Nothing," said Kit.
"Making rude comments about the Centaurians," said Livy.
For a moment, Kit thought Christina was going to scold them. Instead, she sat down next to Livy, her mouth curling up into a smile.
"Count me in," she said.
Ty was resting his forearm on the crossbar. He flicked his storm cloud gray eyes in Kit's direction.
"Tomorrow," he said quietly, "we follow them to see where they go."
Kit was surprised to find he was looking forward to it.
It was an uncomfortable evening. The Centaurians, even after drying off, were exhausted and reluctant to talk about what they'd done that day. Instead, they descended on the dining room and the food laid out there, like ravenous wolves. Kit, Ty, and Livy were nowhere to be seen. Emma didn't blame them. Meals with the Centaurians were an increasingly uncomfortable affair. Though Divya, Rayon, and John Cartwright tried their best to hold up a friendly conversation about where everyone planned to spend their travel year, Zara soon interrupted them with a long description of what she'd been doing in Hungary before she'd arrived at the Institute. Bunch of shadow hunters complaining that their steelies and seraph blades stopped working during a fight with some fairies, she said, rolling her eyes. We told them it was just an illusion. Fairies fight dirty, and they should be teaching that at the academy. Fairies don't fight dirty, actually, said Mark. They fight remarkably cleanly. They have a strict code of honor.
Honor?
Samantha and Dane laughed at the same time. I doubt you know what that means, Hef. They paused. It had been Dane who was speaking, but it was Samantha who flushed. The word, unspoken, hung in the air. Half-breed. Mark shoved his chair back and walked out of the room.
Sorry, Zara said into the silence that followed his departure. But he shouldn't be sensitive. He's going to hear a lot worse if he goes to Alicante, especially at a council meeting.
Emma stared at her incredulously.
That doesn't make it all right, she said. Just because he's going to hear something ugly from the bigots on the council doesn't mean he should hear it first at home.
Or ever at home, said Christina, whose cheeks had turned dark red.
Stop trying to make us feel guilty, Samantha snapped. We're the ones who've been out all day trying to clean up the mess you made. Trusting Malcolm Fade, like you could trust a damn worlder. Didn't you people learn anything from the Dark War? The fairies stabbed us in the back. That's what downworlders do. And Mark and Helen will do it, to you too, if you're not careful.
You don't know anything about my brother or my sister, said Julian. Please refrain from saying their names. Diego had been sitting beside Zara in stony silence. He spoke finally, his lips barely moving. Such blind hatred does no credit to the office or the uniform of Centaurians, he said. Zara lifted her glass, her fingers curled tightly around the slender stem.
I don't hate downworlders, she said, and there was cool conviction in her voice.
It was more chilling somehow than passion would have been.
The Accords haven't worked. The Cold Peace doesn't work. Downworlders don't follow our rules, or any rules that aren't in their interest to follow. They break the Cold Peace when they feel like it. We are warriors. Demons should fear us, and downworlders should fear us. Once we were great. We were feared, and we ruled. We're a shadow now of what we were then. All I'm saying is that when the systems aren't working, when they've brought us down to a level we're at now, then we need a new system. A better one.
Zara smiled, tucked a stray bit of hair back into her immaculate bun, and took a sip of water. They finished dinner in silence.
She lies. She just sits there and lies like her opinions are facts, said Emma furiously.
After dinner, she'd retreated with Christina to the other girl's room. They were both sitting on the bed, Christina worrying her dark hair between her fingers.
I think they are, to her, and those like her, said Christina. But we should not waste time on Zara. You said on the way upstairs that you had something to tell me?
As concisely as she could, Emma caught Christina up on the visit from Gwyn. As Emma talked, Christina's face grew more and more pinched with worry.
Is Mark all right?
I think so. He can be really hard to read sometimes.
He's one of those people with a lot going on in his head, said Christina. Has he ever asked about you and Julian?
Emma shook her head violently.
I don't think it would ever cross his mind that we had anything but parabatai feelings for each other. Jules and I have known each other for so long.
She rubbed at her temples.
Mark assumes Julian feels the same way about me that he does. Brotherly.
It's strange, the things that blind us, said Christina. She drew her knees up, her hands looped around them.
"Have you tried to reach Jaime?" Emma asked.
Christina leaned her cheek on top of her knees.
"I sent a fire message, but I haven't heard anything."
"He was your best friend," Emma said. "He'll respond." She twisted a piece of Christina's woven blanket between her fingers.
"You know what I miss most about Jules? Just being Parabatai. Being Emma and Julian. I miss my best friend. I miss the person I told everything to all the time. The person who knew everything about me. The good things and the bad things."
She could see Julian in her mind's eye as she spoke, the way he had looked during the Dark War, all thin shoulders and determined eyes. The sound of a knock on the door echoed through the room. Emma glanced at Christina. Was she expecting someone? But the other girl looked as surprised as she did.
"Pasa,"
Christina called. It was Julian. Emma looked at him in surprise, the younger Julian of her memory blurring back into the Julian standing in front of her, a nearly grown-up Julian, tall and muscular, his curls unruly, a hint of stubble prickling along his jawline.
"Do you know where Mark is?" he asked without preamble.
"Isn't he in his room?" Emma said. "He left during dinner, so I thought..."
Julian shook his head. "He's not there."
"Could he be in your room?"
It cost him visible effort to ask, Emma thought. She saw Christina bite her lip and prayed Julian wouldn't notice. He could never find out how much Christina knew.
"No," Emma said. "I locked my door." She shrugged. "I don't completely trust the Centaurians."
Julian ran a hand distractedly through his hair.
"Look, I'm worried about Mark. Come with me and I'll show you what I mean."
Christina and Emma followed Julian to Mark's room. The door was propped wide open. Julian went in first, and then Emma and Christina, both of them glancing around carefully, as if Mark might be found hiding in a closet somewhere. Mark's room had changed a great deal since he'd first come back from Faerie. Then it had been dusty, a clearly unused space, kept empty for the sake of memory. All his things had been cleared out and put into storage, and the curtains, filmed with dust, had been always drawn. It was very different now. Mark had folded his clothes in neat stacks at the foot of his bed. He'd told Emma once that he didn't see the point of a wardrobe or a dresser, since all they did was hide your clothes from you. The windowsills were covered with small items from nature. Flowers in various stages of drying, leaves and cactus needles, shells from the beach. The bed was made neatly. Clearly he hadn't slept in it once. Julian looked away from the too orderly bed.
"His boots are gone," he said. "He only had one pair. They were supposed to ship more from Idris, but they haven't yet."
"His jacket, too," Emma said.
It had been his only heavy one, denim-lined with shearling.
"His bag. He had a duffel bag, didn't he?"
Christina gave a gasp. Emma and Julian both swung to look at her, and she reached up for a piece of paper that had just appeared, floating at shoulder height. Glowing runes sealed it shut. They faded as she caught the fire message out of the air.
"Addressed to me," she said, tearing it open, "from Mark."
Her eyes scanned the page, her cheeks paled, and she handed over the paper without a word. Julian took the message, and Emma read over his shoulder as he studied it.
"My dear Christina, I know you will show this to the right people at the right time. I can always trust you to do what is necessary when it needs to be done. By now you know what has happened with Kieran's arrest. Though things ended badly between us, he was my protector for many Faerie years. I owe him, and I cannot leave him to die in the grim court of his father. I take the Moon's Road for Faerie tonight. Tell my brothers and sisters I will return to them as soon as I can. Tell Emma I will be back. I returned to them from the land under the hill once before. I will do it again. Mark Blackthorne."
Julian crumpled the paper viciously between unsteady fingers. "I'm going after him." Emma started to reach for his arm before remembering and dropped her hand to her side.
"I'm coming with you."
"No," Julian said.
"Do you understand what Mark's trying to do?
He can't invade the Unseelie Court by himself. The King of Shadows will have him killed before he can blink.
Of course I understand, said Emma. That's why we need to get to Mark before he makes it to an entrance into Faerie. Once he enters the Fair Folk's lands, it'll be practically impossible to intercept him.
There's also the issue of time, said Christina. Once he crosses the border, time will be different for him. He could come back in 3 days or 3 weeks.
Or 3 years, said Emma grimly.
Which is why I should go after him now, said Julian, before he makes it into Faerie and time starts being our enemy.
I can help with that, Christina said.
Faeries had been Christina's special field of study when she was growing up. She'd once confessed to Emma that this had been partly because of Mark and what she'd learned about him as a child. He'd fascinated her, the shadow hunter boy taken by fairies during the Dark War. Christina touched the pendant at her throat, the golden pendant that bore an image of Raziel.
This is a fairy-blessed charm. My family has, she hesitated, many of them. Years ago, they were close with the fair folk. We still have many tokens of their regard. We speak of it little, though, as the Clave's attitude toward those who befriend fair folk is, she glanced around Mark's room, as you know it to be.
What does the charm do? Said Emma.
It keeps time from passing too quickly for mortals in the fair folk's realm. Christina held the pendant between her fingers, gazing at Jules with quiet inquiry, as if to say she had many more surprises up her neat sleeves, if he cared to hear them.
It's only one pendant, said Julian. How can it protect us all?
If I wear it into the realm, the protection will extend to you and Emma and Mark, too, as long as you do not go too far away from me.
Julian leaned against the wall and sighed.
And I suppose you're not going to consider just giving it to me, so I can wear it into Faerie by myself?
Absolutely not, Christina said primly. It's a family heirloom.
Emma could have kissed Christina. She settled for winking at her. The corner of Christina's lip curled up slightly.
Then the three of us will go, Emma said, and Julian seemed to realize there would be no point in disagreement.
He nodded at her, and there was a little of the old Parabatai look in his eye, the look that said that he expected the two of them to enter into danger together.
The pendant will also allow us to take the Moon's Road, said Christina. Usually only those with fairy blood can access it. She squared her shoulders. Mark will not imagine that we could follow him. That is why he sent the note.
The Moon's Road? Julian said. What is that exactly?
At that, Christina did smile. It was an odd smile, not quite a look of happiness. And Emma expected that she was too worried for that. But there was a little bit of wonder in it. The look of someone who was getting to experience something they never thought they'd get a chance to.
I'll show you, she said.
They gathered their things swiftly. The house was dark, unusually alive with the untidy breathing of multiple sleepers. As Julian moved down the hallway, sliding the straps of his pack over his shoulders, he saw Ty asleep in front of Kit's room, half sitting up, his chin in his hand. A book was open beside him on the floor. Julian paused at the door to the attic. He hesitated. He could leave a note, walk away. That would be the easier thing to do. There wasn't much time. They had to get Mark before he got into Faerie. It wouldn't be cowardly, just practical, just... He shoved the door open and pounded up the stairs. Arthur was where he had left him, at his desk. Moonlight streamed in, angular, through the skylight. Arthur dropped his pen and turned to look at Julian. Gray hair framed his tired blackthorn eyes. It was like looking at a blurred picture of Julian's father, something that had been flawed in the development process, pulling the angles of his face out of familiar alignment.
I have to leave for a few days, Julian said. If you need anything, talk to Diana. Not to anyone else, just Diana.
Arthur's eyes seemed glazed.
Where are you going, Julian?
Julian considered lying. He was good at lying, and it came easily to him, but for some reason he didn't want to. Mark went back, he said. I'm going to get him, hopefully before he crosses over into Faerie.
A shudder went through Arthur's body.
You're going after your brother and Fairy? He said hoarsely,
and Julian remembered the shreds of what he knew of his uncle's story, that he had been trapped with Julian's father, Andrew, in Fairy for years, that Andrew had fallen in love with a gentry woman and fathered Helen and Mark on her, but Arthur had been separated from him, locked away, tortured with enchantments. Yes, Julian shifted his back to one shoulder. Arthur reached his hand out as if he meant to take Julian's, and Julian flinched back, startled. His uncle never touched him. Arthur dropped his hand.
In the Republic of Rome, he said, there was always a servant assigned to every general who won a war. When the general rode through the streets, accepting the thanks of a grateful people, the servant's task was to whisper in his ear, Respice poste, hominum te esse memento, memento mori.
Look behind you, Julian translated. Remember that you are a man. Remember that you will die. A faint shiver went up his spine.
You're young, but you're not immortal, Arthur said. If you find yourself in Fairy, and I pray that you do not, for it is hell there if there ever was a hell, if you find yourself there. Listen to nothing the fairies tell you. Listen to none of their promises. Swear to me, Julian.
Julian exhaled. He thought of that long-ago general, being exhorted not to let glory go to his head, to remember that everything passed, everything went, happiness went, and so did loss and pain. Everything but love.
I swear, he said.
We have to wait for a moment, said Christina, where the moon on the water seems solid. You can see it if you look, like the green flash. She smiled at Emma, who stood between Jules and Christina, the three of them in a line at the edge of the ocean. There was little wind, and the ocean stretched out before them, thick and black, edged with white where the water met the sand. Surges of sea foam, where the waves had broken and spent themselves on the tide line, pushed seaweed and bits of shells farther up the beach. The sky had cleared from the earlier storm. The moon was high, casting a perfect, unbroken line of light across the water, reaching toward the horizon. The waves made a soft noise like whispers as they spilled around Emma's feet, the surf lapping at her waterproofed boots. Jules had his gaze on his watch. It had been his father's, a large old-fashioned mechanical watch, gleaming on his wrist. Emma saw with a slight lurch that the sea-glass bracelet she'd fashioned for him was still on his wrist beside it, shining in the moonlight.
Almost midnight, he said. I wonder how much of a head start Mark has.
It depends on how long he had to wait for the right moment to step on the path, said Christina. Such moments come and go. Midnight is only one of them.
So, how are we planning on capturing him? Emma said. Just your basic chase and tackle, or are we going to try to distract him with the power of dance and then lasso his ankles?
Joke's not helping, said Julian, staring at the water.
Jokes always help, said Emma, especially when we're not doing anything else but waiting for the water to solidify.
Christina squeaked.
Go, now!
Emma went first, leaping over a small wave crashing at her feet. Half her brain was telling her that she was throwing herself into water, that she'd splash down into it. The impact when her boots struck a hard surface was jarring. She took a few running steps and spun around to face the beach. She was standing on a gleaming path that looked as if it were made of hard rock crystal, cut thin as glass. The moonlight on the water had become solid. Julian was already behind her, balanced on the shimmering line, and Christina was leaping onto the path behind him. She heard Christina gasp as she landed. As shadow hunters, they had all seen wonders, but there was something distinctly fairy about this kind of magic. It seemed to take place in the interstices of the normal world, between light and shadow, between one minute and another. As Nephilim, they existed in their own space. This was between. Let's move, Julian said, and Emma began to walk. The path was wide. It seemed to flex and curl under her feet, with the motion and ripple of the tide. It was like walking on a bridge held suspended over a chasm. Except that when she looked down, she didn't see empty space. She saw what she feared much more. The deep darkness of the ocean, where her parents' dead bodies had floated before they washed up on the shore. For years she had imagined them struggling, dying underwater, miles of sea all around, totally alone. She knew more now about how they'd died, knew they'd been dead when Malcolm Fade had consigned their bodies to the sea. But you couldn't speak to fear, couldn't tell it the truth. Fear lived in your bones. This far out, Emma would have expected the water to be so deep it was opaque. But the moonlight made it glow as if from within. She could gaze down into it as if into an aquarium. She saw the fronds of seaweed moving and dancing with the push and pull of the tides, the flutter of schools of fish. Darker shadows, too, bigger ones. Flickers of movement, heavy and enormous, a whale, perhaps, or something bigger and worse. Water demons could grow to the size of football fields. She imagined the path breaking up suddenly, giving way, and all of them plunging into the darkness, the enormity all around them, cold and deathly, and filled with blind-eyed, shark-toothed monsters. And the angel knew what else, rising up out of the deep. "Don't look down," it was Julian, approaching on the path. Christina was a little behind him, looking around in wonder. "Look straight ahead at the horizon. Walk toward that." She raised her chin. She could feel Jules next to her, feel the warmth coming off his skin, raising the hair along her arms.
"I'm fine."
"You're not," he said flatly. "I know how you feel about the ocean." They were far out from shore now. It was a shining line in the distance, the highway, a ribbon of moving lights, the houses and restaurants along the coastline glimmering.
"Well, as it turns out, my parents didn't die in the ocean."
She took a shuddering breath.
"They didn't drown."
"Knowing that doesn't wipe out years of bad dreams," Julian glanced toward her. The wind blew soft tendrils of his hair against his cheekbones. She remembered what it felt like to have her hands in that hair, how holding him had anchored her, not just to the world, but to herself.
"I hate feeling like this," she said, and for a moment even she wasn't sure what she was talking about. "I hate being afraid. It makes me feel weak."
"Emma, everyone's afraid of something." Julian moved closer. She felt his shoulder bump hers. "We fear things because we value them. We fear losing people because we love them. We fear dying because we value being alive. Don't wish you didn't fear anything. All that would mean is that you didn't feel anything."
"Jules."
She started to turn toward him in surprise at the intensity in his voice, but paused when she heard Christina's footsteps quicken, and then her voice raised in recognition, calling,
"Mark!"
Chapter 8. Near the River. Emma saw Mark immediately, a shadow out on the gleaming path before them, the moonlight sparkling off his pale hair. He didn't seem to have noticed them yet. Emma began to run, Christina and Jules at her heels. Though the path surged and dipped under her, she was used to running on the beach where the soft sand gave way under her feet. She could see Mark clearly now. He'd stopped walking and turned to face them, looking astonished. His gear was gone. He was wearing clothes similar to the ones he'd come to the Institute in, though clean and undamaged, linen and soft, tanned hide, high-laced boots, and a duffel bag slung over his back. Emma could see the stars reflected in his wide eyes as she drew closer to him. He dropped the duffel bag at his feet, looking accusingly at his three pursuers.
"What are you doing here?"
"Seriously?" Julian kicked Mark's duffel bag aside, grabbing hold of his brother's shoulders. "What are you doing here?" Julian was taller than Mark, a fact that always struck Emma as odd. Mark had been taller for so many years, taller and older, but he was neither now. He looked like a slim, pale blade in the darkness, against Julian's more solid strength and height. He looked as if he might at any moment turn into moonlight on the waves and vanish. He turned his gaze to Christina.
You got my fire message?
She nodded, tendrils of her dark hair caught in a jeweled clip at the back of her head, curling around her face.
We all read it.
Mark closed his eyes.
I had not thought you could follow me on the moon's road.
But we did. Julian tightened his hands on Mark's shoulders. You're not going anywhere in Faerie, much less alone.
It's for Kieran, Mark said simply.
Kieran betrayed you, said Julian.
They will kill him, Jules, said Mark. Because of me. Kieran killed Irloth because of me.
He opened his eyes to gaze into his brother's face.
I should not have tried to leave without telling you. That was unfair of me. I know you would try to stop me, and I knew I had little time. I will never forgive Kieran for what happened to you and Emma, but I will not leave him to death and torture either.
Mark, the fair folk aren't fond of you, said Julian. They were forced to give you back, and they hate giving back anything they take. If you go into Faerie, they'll keep you there if they can, and it won't be easy. They will hurt you. I won't let that happen.
Then you will be my jailer, brother?
Mark held out his hands, palms up. You will bind my wrists in cold iron, my ankles with thorns? Julian flinched. It was too dark to see Mark's blackthorn features, his blue-green eye, and in the dimness the brothers seemed only a shadow hunter and a fairy, eternally at odds.
Emma, Julian said, removing his hands from Mark's shoulders. There was a desperate bitterness in his voice.
Mark loves you. You convince him.
Emma felt Julian's bitterness like thorns under her skin and heard Mark's anguished words again.
Will you be my jailer? We aren't going to stop you from going. We're going to go with you. Even in the moonlight, she could see Mark's face lose color.
No!
You're obviously Nephilim. You're in gear. Your runes aren't hidden. Shadowhunters are not well-loved in the land under the hill.
Apparently only Kieran is, said Julian. He's lucky to have your loyalty, Mark, since we don't.
At that, Mark flushed and turned toward his brother, his eyes glittering angrily.
All right, stop, stop,
Emma said, taking a step toward them. The shimmering water bent and flexed beneath her feet.
Both of you.
Who walks the path of moonlight?
A figure approached, its voice a deep boom above the waves. Julian's hand went to the hilt of the dagger at his waist. Emma's seraph blade was out. Christina had her balisong in hand. Mark's fingers had reached for the place where the elf bolt Kieran had given him had once rested in the hollow of his throat. It was gone now. His face tightened before relaxing into recognition.
It's a puka, he said under his breath. Mostly they're harmless.
The figure on the path before them had drawn closer. It was a tall fairy, dressed in ragged trousers held up by a belt of rope. Thin strands of gold were woven into his long dark hair and gleamed against his dark skin. His feet were bare. He spoke, and his voice sounded like the tide at sunset.
Seek you to enter through the gate of Lear?
Yes, said Mark.
Metallic gold eyes without irises or pupils passed over Mark, Christina, Julian, and Emma.
Only one of you is Fae, the Puka said. The others are human.
No, Nephilim.
Thin lips curled into a smile.
That is a surprise. How many of you wish to pass through the gate to the Shadowlands?
All of us, said Emma. The four.
If the king or queen finds you, they will kill you, said the Puka. The fair folk are not friendly to the angel-blooded, not since the cold peace.
I am half-fairy, said Mark. My mother was the Lady Nerissa of the Seelie Court.
The Puka raised his eyebrows.
Her death grieved us all.
And these are my brothers and sisters, Mark continued, pressing his advantage. They would accompany me.
I will protect them.
The Pooka shrugged. It is not my concern what befalls you in the lands, he said. Only that first you must pay the toll. No payments, said Julian, his hand tightening on his dagger hilt. No tolls. The Pooka smiled. Come here and speak to me for a moment in private, and then decide if you would pay my price. I will not force you.
Julian's expression darkened, but he stepped forward. Emma strained to hear what he was saying to the Pooka, but the sound of wind and waves slid between them. Behind them the air swirled and clouded. Emma thought she could see a shape in it, arched like the shape of a door. Julian stood motionless as the Pooka spoke, but Emma saw a muscle twitch in his cheek. A moment later, he unsnapped his father's watch from around his wrist and dropped it into the Pooka's hand.
One payment, said the Pooka loudly as Julian turned away. Who would come next?
I will, said Christina, and moved carefully across the path toward the Pooka.
Julian rejoined Mark and Emma.
Did he threaten you? Emma whispered. Jules, if he threatened you?
He didn't, Julian said. I wouldn't let Christina near him if he had.
Emma turned to watch as Christina reached up and pulled the jeweled clip from her hair. It cascaded down over her back and shoulders, blacker than the night sea. She handed the clip over and began to walk back toward them, looking dazed.
Mark Blackthorn will go last, said the Pooka. Let the golden-haired girl come to me next.
Emma could feel the others watching her as she went toward the Pooka, Julian more intensely than the rest. She thought of the painting he'd done of her, where she'd risen above the ocean with a body made of stars. She wondered what he'd done with those paintings, if he'd thrown them all out. Were they gone? Burned? Her heart ached at the thought. Such lovely work of Jules, every brushstroke a whisper, a promise. She reached the ferry, who stood slyly smiling, as his kind did when they were amused. All around them the sea stretched, black and silver. The Pooka bent his head to speak to her. The wind rushed up around them. She stood with him inside a circle of cloud. She could no longer see the others.
If you're going to threaten me, she said before he could speak, understand that I will hunt you down for it, if not now, then later, and I will make you die for a long time.
The Pooka laughed. His teeth were also gold, tipped in silver. Emma Carstairs, he said. I see you know little about Pookas. We are seducers, not bullies. When I tell you what I tell you, you will wish to go to Ferry. You will wish to give me what I ask for.
And what do you ask for?
That steely, he said, pointing to the one in her belt.
Everything in Emma rebelled. The steely had been given to her by Jace years ago in Idris after the Dark War. It was a symbol of everything that had marked her life after the war. Clary had given her words, and she had treasured them. Jace had given her a steely, and with it given a grief-stricken and frightened girl a purpose. When she touched the steely, it whispered that purpose to her. The future is yours now. Make it what you will.
What use could a fairy have for a steely? She asked. You don't draw runes, and they only work for shadow hunters.
No use for a steely, he said, but for the precious demon bone of the handle, quite a lot.
She shook her head. Choose something else.
The Pooka leaned in. He smelled of salt and seaweed baking in the sun. Listen, he said. If you enter Ferry, you will again see the face of someone you loved, who is dead.
What?
Shock stabbed through Emma.
You're lying.
You know I cannot lie. Emma's mouth had gone dry. You must not tell the others what I told you, or it will not happen, said the Pooka. Nor can I tell you what it means. I am only a messenger. But the message is true.
If you wish to look again upon one you have loved and lost, if you wish to hear their voice, you must pass through the gate of Lear.
Emma drew the stele from her belt. A pang went through her as she handed it over. She turned away blindly from the puka, his words ringing in her ears. She was barely aware of Mark brushing past her, the last to speak to the water fairy. Her heart was pounding too hard.
One you have loved and lost. But there were many, so many, lost in the dark war. Her parents, but she dared not even think of them. She would lose her ability to think, to go on. The Blackthorn's father, Andrew, her old tutor, Katerina, maybe.
The sound of wind and waves died down. Mark stood before the puka in silence, his face pale. All three of the others looked stricken, and Emma burned to know what the fairy had told them. What could compel Jules or Mark or Christina to cooperate? The puka thrust out his hand.
Lear's gate opens, he said. Take it now, or flee back toward the shore. The moon's road begins to dissolve already.
There was a sound like shattering ice melting under spring sunlight. Emma looked down. The shining path below was riven with black where the water was springing up through the cracks. Julian grabbed her hand.
We have to go, he said.
Behind Mark, who stood ahead of them on the path, an archway of water had formed. It gleamed bright silver. The inside of it churned with water in motion. With a laugh, the puka leapt from the path with an elegant dive and slipped between the waves. Emma realized she had no idea what Mark had given him. Not that it seemed to matter now. The path between them was shattering rapidly. Now it was in pieces, like ice floes in the Arctic. Christina was on Emma's other side. The three of them pushed forward, leaping from one solid piece of path to another. Mark was gesturing toward them, shouting, the archway behind him solidifying. Emma could see green grass through it, moonlight and trees. She pushed Christina forward, Mark caught her, and the two of them vanished through the gate. She moved to take a step forward, but the path gave way under her feet. For what seemed like much more than seconds, she tumbled toward the black water. Then Julian had caught her, his arms around her. They fell together through the arch. The shadows had lengthened in the attic. Arthur sat motionless, gazing out the window with its torn paper at the moonlight over the sea. He could guess where Julian and the others were now. He knew the moon's road as he knew the other roads of Faerie. He had been driven down them by hooting packs of pixies and goblins, riding ahead of their masters, the unearthly beautiful princes and princesses of the gentry. Once, in a winter forest, he had fallen, and his body had shattered the ice of a pond. He recalled watching his blood spray across the pond's silvered surface.
How pretty,
a fairy lady had mused as Arthur's blood melted into the ice. He thought of his mind that way sometimes, a shattered surface reflecting back a broken and imperfect picture. He knew his madness was not like human madness. It came and went, sometimes leaving him barely touched, so he hoped it was gone forever. Then it would return, crushing him beneath a parade of people no one else could see, a chorus of voices no one else could hear. The medicine helped, but the medicine was gone. Julian had always brought the medicine, from the time he was a small boy. Arthur wasn't sure how old he was now, old enough. Sometimes Arthur wondered if he loved the boy, if he loved any of his brother's children. There had been times he had awoken from dreams in which terrible things had happened to them, with his face wet with tears. But that might have been guilt. He had lacked either the ability to raise them or the bravery to let the Clave replace him with a better guardian. Oh, who would have kept them together? No one, perhaps. And a family should be together. The door at the foot of the stairs creaked. Arthur turned eagerly. Perhaps Julian had thought better of his mad plan and returned. The moon's road was dangerous. The sea itself was full of treachery. He had grown up near the sea, in Cornwall, and he recalled its monsters.
And bitter as blood is the spray, and the crests are as fangs that devour.
Or perhaps there never been monsters. She appeared at the top of the steps and looked at him coolly. Her hair was pulled back so tightly her skin seemed stretched. She tilted her head, taking in the cramped, dirty room, the papered-over windows.
There was something in her face, something that stirred a flicker of memory, something that made cold terror wash through him.
He gripped the arms of his chair, his mind chattering with bits of old poetry.
Her skin was white as leprosy. The nightmare life in death was she.
Arthur Blackthorne, I presume, she said with a demure smile. I'm Zara Dearborn. I believe you knew my father. Emma landed hard on thick grass, tangled up in Julian. For a moment he was propped over her, elbows on the ground, his pale face luminous in the moonlight. The air around them was cold, but his body was warm against hers. She felt the expansion of his chest as he inhaled, a sharp breath, the current of air against her cheek as he turned his face quickly away from hers. A moment later he was on his feet, reaching down to pull her up after him. But she scrambled upright on her own, spinning around to see they were standing in a clearing surrounded by trees.
The moonlight was bright enough for Emma to see that the grass was intensely green. The trees hung with fruit that was vividly colored. Purple plums, red apples, star and rose-shaped fruits that Emma didn't recognize.
Mark and Christina were there too, under the trees. Mark had pushed the sleeves of his shirt up and was holding his hands out as if he were touching the air of Fairy, feeling it on his skin. He tipped his head back, his mouth slightly open. Emma, looking at him, blushed. It felt like a private moment, as if she were watching someone reconnect with a lover.
Emma, Christina breathed. Look.
She pointed upward at the sky. The stars were different. They arched and whirled in patterns that Emma didn't recognize, and they had colors. Icy blue, frost green, shimmering gold, brilliant silver.
It's so beautiful,
she whispered. She saw Julian look over at her, but it was Mark who spoke. He no longer looked quite so abandoned to the night, but he still seemed a little dazed, as if the air of Fairy were wine and he had drunk too much.
The hunt rode through the sky of Fairy sometimes, he said. In the sky, the stars looked like the crushed dust of jewels, powdered ruby and sapphire and diamond.
I knew about the stars in Fairy, Christina said in an awed, quiet voice. But I never thought I would see them myself.
Should we rest? Julian asked. He was prowling the outline of the clearing, peering between the trees. Trust Jules to ask the practical questions. Gather our energy for traveling tomorrow? Mark shook his head. We can't. We must travel through the night. I know how to navigate the lands only by stars.
Then we're going to need energy runes.
Emma held out her arm to Christina. It wasn't meant as a deliberate snub to Jules. Runes your Parabatai put on you were always more powerful, but she could still feel where his body had crushed against hers when they'd fallen. She could still feel the visceral twist inside her when his breath had ghosted against her cheek. She needed him not to be close to her right now, not to see what was in her eyes. The way Mark had looked at the sky of Fairy, that was how she imagined she looked at Julian. Christina's touch was warm and comforting, her steely, swift and skilled, its tip tracing the shape of an energy rune onto Emma's forearm. Finished, she let Emma's wrist go. Emma waited for the usual alert, searing heat like a double jolt of caffeine. Nothing happened.
It's not working, she said with a frown.
Let me see. Christina stepped forward. She glanced down at Emma's skin, and her eyes widened. Look. The mark, black as ink when Christina had placed it on Emma's forearm, was turning pale and silvery, fading like melting frost. In seconds it had blended back into Emma's skin and was gone. What on earth? Emma began, but Julian had already whirled on Mark. Runes, he said. Do they work in Faerie? Mark looked astonished. It had never occurred to me that they wouldn't, he said. No one's ever mentioned it. I've studied Faerie for years, Christina said. I've never seen it said anywhere that runes do not work in the lands. When was the last time you tried to use one here? Emma asked Mark. He shook his head, blonde curls falling into his eyes. He shoved them back with narrow fingers. I can't remember, he said. I didn't have a steely. They broke it, but my witch light always worked. He dug into his pocket and drew out a round, polished runestone. They all watched, breathless, as he held it up, waiting for the light to come, to shine brilliantly from his palm. Nothing happened. With a soft curse, Julian drew one of his seraph blades from his belt. The adamas gleamed dully in the moonlight. He turned it so that the blade lay flat, reflecting the multicolored brilliance of the stars. Michael, he said. Something sparked inside the blade, a brief, dull gleam. Then it was gone. Julian stared at it. A seraph blade that could not be brought to life was barely more than a plastic knife, dull-bladed, heavy, and short. With a violent jerk of his arm, Julian cast the blade aside. It skidded across the grass. He raised his eyes. Emma could sense how tightly he was holding back. She felt it like a pressure in her own body that made it hard to breathe. So, he said, we're going to have to journey across Faerie, a place where shadow hunters aren't welcome, using only the stars to navigate. And we can't use runes, seraph blades, or witch light? Is that the situation, roughly?
I would say it's the situation exactly, said Mark.
Also, we're heading for the Unseelie Court, Emma added, which is supposed to be like one of those horror movies Drew likes, but less, you know, fun.
Then we will travel at night, Christina said. She pointed into the distance. There are landmarks that I've seen on maps. Do you see those ridges in the distance against the sky? I think those are the Thorn Mountains. The Unseelie lands lie in their shadow. It's not so far away.
Emma could see Mark relax at the sound of Christina's sensible voice. It didn't seem to be working on Julian, though. His jaw was clenched, his hands, rigid fists at his sides. It wasn't that Julian didn't get angry. It was that he didn't let himself show it. People thought he was quiet, calm, but that was deceptive. Emma recalled something that she had read once, that volcanoes had the lushest green slopes, the loveliest and quietest aspect, because the fire that pulsed through them kept their earth from ever freezing. But when they erupted, they could rain down devastation for miles.
Jules, she said. He glanced over at her. Fury gleamed behind his eyes. We might not have witch light or runes, but we are still shadow hunters. With everything that means, we can do this. We can.
It felt like a clumsy speech to her, but she saw the fire die in his eyes.
You're right, he said. Sorry. And I'm sorry for bringing you all here, said Mark. If I had known about the runes. But it must be something recent, very much so.
You didn't bring us here, said Christina. We followed you. And we all came through not just for you, but because of what the Pooka told each of us. Isn't that true?
One you have loved and lost.
It's true for me, said Emma. She glanced at the sky. We should get going, though. Morning is probably in just a few hours. And if we don't have energy runes, we'll have to get our energy the old-fashioned way.
Mark looked puzzled.
Drugs? Chocolate, Emma said. I brought chocolate.
Mark, where do you even come up with these things?
Mark smiled crookedly, shrugging one shoulder.
Faerie humor?
I thought fairies mostly made jokes at other people's expense and played pranks on mundanes, said Julian.
Sometimes they tell very long, rhyming stories they think are hilarious, said Mark. But I have to admit, I never really understood why.
Julian sighed. That actually sounds worse than anything else I've heard about the Unseelie Court. Mark shot Julian a grateful look, as if to say he understood that his brother had mastered his temper, in part for him, for all of them, so that they would be all right, so that they could continue on their way and find Kieran, with Julian leading them, as he always did.
Come, Mark said, turning. It is this way. We should begin walking. It may not be very many more hours until dawn.
Mark headed into the shadows between the trees. Mist clung to the branches like ropes of white and silver. Leaves rustled softly in the wind above their heads. Julian moved to walk up ahead next to his brother. Emma could hear him asking,
"Puns? At least promise me there won't be puns."
"The way the boys tell each other they love each other is so very odd," said Christina as she and Emma ducked beneath a branch. "Why can't they just say it? Is it so difficult?"
Emma grinned at her friend.
"I love you, Christina," she said, "and I'm glad you're getting to visit Fairy, even if it's under weird circumstances. Maybe you can find a hot fairy guy and forget about imperfect Diego."
Christina smiled.
"I love you too, Emma," she said, "and maybe I will."
Kit's list of grievances against the Shadow Hunters had now gotten long enough that he'd started writing it down.
"Stupid, hot people," he'd written. "Won't let me go home and get my stuff. They won't tell me anything about what it would mean to actually become a Shadow Hunter. Would I have to go somewhere and train? They won't tell me how long I can stay here, except as long as you need to. Don't I have to go to school eventually? Some kind of school? They won't talk about the cold piece or how it sucks. They won't let me eat cookies."
He thought for a while, and then crossed that one out. They did let him eat cookies. He just suspected they were judging him for it.
"They don't seem to understand what autism is, or mental illness, or therapy, or medical treatment. Do they believe in things like chemotherapy? What if I get cancer? Probably won't get cancer, but if I did. They won't tell me how Tessa and Jem found my dad, or why my dad hated Shadow Hunters so much."
That one was the hardest to write.
Kit had always thought of his father as a small-time con man, a lovable rogue, a sort of Han Solo type, swindling his way across the galaxy. But lovable rogues don't get torn apart by demons the moment their elaborate protection spells fall apart. And though mostly Kit was confused by what had happened at the Shadow Market, he had learned one thing. His dad had not been like Han Solo. Sometimes, in the dark watches of the night, Kit wondered who he was like himself. Speaking of the dark watches of the night, he had a new grievance to add to his list. "They make me get up early." Diana, whose official title was tutor, and who seemed to function as a guardian slash high school principal, had woken Kit up early in the morning and herded him, along with Ty and Livy, into a corner office with an expansive view and a massive glass desk. She looked pissed off the way adults sometimes looked pissed off when they were angry at someone else, but they were going to take it out on you. Kit was correct. Diana was currently furious at Julian, Emma, Mark, and Christina, who, according to Arthur, had disappeared to Fairy in the dead of night to rescue someone named Kieran, who Kit had never met. Further discussion illuminated that Kieran was the son of the Unseelie King and Mark's ex-boyfriend, both of which were interesting pieces of information that Kit filed away for later.
"This is not good," Diana finished. "Any travel to Fairy is entirely off limits to Nephilim, without special permissions."
"But they'll come back, right?" Ty said. He sounded strained.
"Mark will come back." "Of course they'll come back," said Livy. "It's just a mission, a rescue mission," she added, turning to Diana. "Won't the Clave understand they had to go?"
"Rescuing a fairy? No," Diana said, shaking her head.
They are not entitled to our protection under the Accords. The Centaurians can't know. The Clave would be furious.
I won't tell, said Ty.
I won't either, agreed Livy, obviously.
They both looked at Kit.
I don't even know why I'm here, he said.
You have a point, said Livy. She turned to Diana. Why is he here?
You seem to have a way of knowing everything, Diana said to Kit. I thought it would be better to control your information and get a promise from you.
That I won't tell? Of course I won't tell. I don't even like Centaurians. They're what I always thought Shadowhunters would be like. You're not. You're all different.
Jerks, he finished. I cannot believe, Livy said, that Julian and them have found a fun adventure to go on and just left the rest of us here to fetch towels for the Centaurians.
Diana looked surprised.
I thought you'd be upset, she said, worried about them.
Livy shook her head. Her long hair, shades lighter than Ty's, flew around her.
That they're off having fun and getting to see Fairy while we drudge around here? When they get back, I'm going to have words with Julian.
Which words? Ty looked confused for a moment before his face cleared. Oh, he said, you're going to curse him out.
I'm going to use every bad word I know.
Look up some other ones, said Livy. Diana was biting her lip.
You're really all right?
Ty nodded. Christina has studied Fairy extensively. Mark was a hunter, and Julian and Emma are clever and brave, he said. I'm sure they'll be fine. Diana looked stunned. Kit had to admit he was surprised, too. The Blackthorns had struck him as a family so close-knit that Imesh didn't begin to cover it. But Livy kept up her cheerful annoyance when they went to tell Drew and Tavi that the others had gone to the Shadow Hunter Academy to fetch something. She was quite convincing, too, as she told them how Christina had gone along, because visiting the academy was now a required part of one's travel year. And they repeated the same story to a glowering Diego and a bunch of Centaurians, including his fiancé, who Kit had taken to calling Loathsome Zara in his mind.
In sum, Livy finished sweetly, you may have to launder some of your own towels. Now, if you'll excuse us, Ty and I are going to take Kit here on a tour of the perimeter.
Zara arched an eyebrow.
The perimeter?
The wards you just put up, said Livy, and marched outside. She didn't actually drag Ty and Kit after her physically, but something about the force of her personality accomplished basically the same thing. The Institute doors fell shut behind them, as she was already clattering down the front steps.
Did you see the look on those Centaurians' faces? She demanded as they made their way around the massive side of the Institute.
She was wearing boots and denim shorts that showed off her long, tanned legs. Kit attempted to seem as if he wasn't looking.
I don't think they appreciated what you said about washing their own towels, said Ty.
Maybe I should have drawn them a map to where the detergent is, said Livy. You know, since they like maps so much.
Kit laughed. Livy glanced over at him, half suspicious.
What?
They passed the parking lot behind the Institute and reached a low hedge of sagebrush, behind which was a statuary garden. Greek playwrights and historians stood around in plaster poses, holding wreaths of laurel. It seemed oddly out of place, but then Los Angeles was a city of things that didn't seem like they belonged where they were.
It was funny, Kit said. That was all.
She smiled. Her blue t-shirt matched her eyes, and the sunlight found the red and copper threads in her dark brown hair and made them shine. At first, Kit had been a little unnerved by how much the Blackthorns all looked like each other, except Ty, of course. But he had to admit, if he had to share family traits, luminous blue-green eyes and wavy dark hair weren't bad ones. The only things he shared with his father were moodiness and a penchant for burglary. As for his mother...
Ty, Livy called. Ty, get down from there.
They had moved far enough away from the house that they were now in real chaparral desert. Kit had only been in the Santa Monica Mountains a few times on school trips. He remembered drinking in the air, the mix of salt and sagebrush, the soft, breathless heat of the desert, Hasty green lizards bloomed like sudden leaves in between the scrub cactus and disappeared just as quickly. Large rocks were tumbled everywhere, the cast-offs of some fast-moving glacier a million years ago. "I will, when I'm done with this." Ty was busy climbing one of the largest rocks, expertly finding handholds and footholds. He hauled himself up to the top, totally unselfconscious, arms out to keep his balance. He looked as if he were getting ready to launch himself into flight, his hair blowing back like dark wings. "Is he going to be all right?" Kit asked, watching him climb. "He's a really good climber," said Livy. "It used to freak me out when we were younger. He didn't have any kind of realistic sense of when he was in danger or wasn't. I thought he was going to fall off the rocks at Leo Carrillo and smash in his head. But Jules went with him everywhere, and Diana showed him how, and he learned." She looked up at her brother and smiled. Ty had raised himself up on the balls of his feet and was looking down at the ocean. Kit could almost imagine him on a desolate plain somewhere, with a black cloak flapping around him like a hero in a fantasy illustration. Kit took a deep breath.
"You didn't really believe what you told Diana," he said to Livy.
She whipped around to stare at him. "About not being worried about Julian and the others."
"Why do you think that?"
Her tone was carefully neutral.
"I've been watching you," he said. "All of you."
"I know." She looked up at him with her bright eyes, half amused. "It's like you've been taking mental notes." "Habit. My dad taught me everyone in the world was divided into two categories. Those you could trick and cheat, and the ones you couldn't. So you observe people, try to figure out what they're about, how they tick."
"How do we tick?"
"Like a very complicated machine," said Kit. "You're all entwined. One of you moves a little, and that drives the others. And if you move the other way, that directs what they do, too. You're more connected than any family I've seen. And you can't tell me you're not worried about Julian and the others. I know you are. I know what you people think about the fair folk. That they're evil? It's a lot more complicated than that, believe me." Livy's blue gaze darted away toward her brother. Ty was lying down on his back on the rock now, barely visible.
"So why would I lie to Diana?"
"Julian lies to protect all of you," said Kit. "If he's not around, then you'll lie to protect the younger ones."
"Nothing to worry about. Julian and Mark are off to the Unseelie Court. Hope they send a postcard. Wish we were there."
Livy seemed poised between irritation and relief, angry that Kit had guessed the truth, relieved there was someone with whom she didn't have to pretend.
"Do you think I convinced Diana?" she said finally.
"I think you convinced her you weren't worried," said Kit. "She's still worried. She's probably pulling whatever strings she's got to pull to figure out how to find them."
"We're pretty low on strings here, you might have noticed," Livy said. "As institutes go, we're a weird one."
"I don't really have a lot of points of reference, but I believe you."
"So you didn't actually tell me," Livy tucked a piece of hair behind her ear. "Are we the kind of people you can trick and cheat, or not?"
"Not," said Kit. "But not because you're shadow hunters. Because you genuinely seem to care about each other more than you care about yourselves. Makes it hard to convince you to be selfish." She took a few steps away, reaching out to touch a small red flower blooming on a silvery green hedge. When she turned back to Kit, her hair was blowing around her face, and her eyes were unnaturally bright. For a moment he worried she might be about to cry or yell at him.
"Kiss me," she said.
Kit didn't know where he'd thought the conversation was going, but definitely not there. He just managed not to start coughing.
"What?
You heard me." She moved back toward him, pacing slowly and deliberately. He tried not to stare at her legs again.
"I asked you to kiss me."
"Why?" She was starting to smile. Behind her, Ty was still balanced on his rock, gazing out to sea.
"Haven't you ever kissed anyone before?" she inquired.
"Yes. I'm not sure how that's relevant, though, to you wanting me to kiss you right now, right here."
"Are you sure you're a Herondale?"
"I'm pretty sure a Herondale would lunge at this kind of opportunity." She crossed her arms over her chest.
Is there some reason you don't want to kiss me? For one, you have a terrifying older brother, said Kit.
I do not have a terrifying older brother. That's true, said Kit. You have two.
Fine, Libby said, dropping her arms and turning away. Fine, if you don't want to. Kit caught her shoulder. It was warm under his grasp, the heat of her skin tactile through the thin material of her t-shirt. I do, though. To his surprise, he meant it. His world was sliding away from him. He felt as if he were falling toward something, a dark unknown, the ragged edge of unwanted choices. And here was a pretty girl offering him something to cling to, a way to forget, something to catch and hold, even if only for a moment. The pulse fluttered lightly in her neck as she half-turned her head, her hair brushing his hand. All right, she said. But tell me one thing. Why me? Why do you want to kiss me?
I've never kissed anyone, she said in a low voice. In my whole life. I hardly ever meet anyone. It's us alone, against the whole world, and I don't mind that. I do anything for my family. But I feel like I'm missing all the chances I should have. You're my age, and you're a shadow hunter, and you don't get on my nerves. I don't have that many options.
You could kiss a Centaurian, Kit suggested. She turned around completely at that, his hand still on her shoulder, her expression indignant. Okay, I guess that suggestion was a little out of bounds, he admitted. The urge to kiss her had become overwhelming, so he gave up trying not to and curved his arm around her shoulder, pulling her closer. Her eyes widened, and then she tilted her head back, her mouth angling toward his, and their mouths slanted together surprisingly gently. It was soft and sweet and warm, and she moved into the circle made by his arm, her hands coming to rest at first hesitantly and then with greater purpose on his shoulders. She gripped tightly, pulling him in, his eyes shutting against the blue dazzle of the ocean in the distance. He forgot the ground under his feet, the world around him, everything but the sense of being comforted by someone holding him, someone caring.
Livy! Ty! Kit!
It was Diana's voice. Kit snapped out of his daze and let Livy go. She moved away from him, looking surprised, one hand rising to touch her lips.
All of you, Diana called. Get back here now. I need your help.
So how was it? Kit asked. Okay for your first?
Not bad, Livy lowered her hand. You really put your back into it. I didn't expect that.
Herondales don't do perfunctory kisses, said Kit. There was a brief flurry of movement, and Ty was down from the rock he'd climbed, picking his way toward them through the desert scrub. Livy gave a short, soft laugh. I think that's the first time I've heard you call yourself a Herondale. Ty joined them, his pale oval face unreadable. Kit couldn't tell anything from his expression, whether he'd seen Kit and Livy kiss or not, though what reason would he have to care if he had?
Looks like it's going to be clear tonight, he said. No clouds coming in.
Livy said something about better weather for following suspicious Centaurians, and she was already moving to walk next to Ty, like she always did. Kit followed after them, hands in the pockets of his jeans, though he could feel the Herondale ring, heavy, on his finger, as if he had only now remembered the weight. The land under the hill. The delightful plain. The place beneath the wave. The lands of the ever-young. As the hours wore on, all the names Emma had ever heard for Fairyland ran through her head. Conversation between the four of them had grown quieter and fallen eventually into an exhausted silence. Christina trudged along beside Emma, wordlessly, her pendant glimmering in the moonlight. Mark led the way, checking their path against the stars every short while. In the distance, the Thorn Mountains became clearer and closer, rising stark and unforgettable against a sky the color of blackened sapphire. The mountains weren't often visible, though. Mostly the path they followed wound through low-hanging trees that grew close together,
boughs occasionally intertwining. More than once, Emma could catch a glimpse of bright eyes flashing out from between the shadows. When tree branches rustled, she would look up to catch sight of shadows moving quickly above them, laughter trailing behind them like mist. "These are the places of the wild fae," said Mark, as the road curved around a hill. "The gentry fae stay within the courts or sometimes town. They like their creature comforts." Here and there were signs of habitation, crumbled mossy bits of old stone walls, wooden fences cleverly fitted together without the use of nails. They passed through several villages in the hour before dawn. Every one of them was shuttered and dark, windows broken and empty. As they went farther into Faerie, they began to see something else, too. The first time they saw it, Emma stopped short and exclaimed. The grass they had been walking on had suddenly dissolved under her feet, puffing up white and gray like ash around her ankles. She looked around in astonishment and discovered that the others were staring, too. They had wandered into the edge of a ragged circle of diseased-looking land. It reminded Emma of photos she'd seen of crop circles. Everything within the perimeter of the circle was a dull, sickly, whitish-gray. The grass, the trees, the leaves and plants. The bones of small animals were scattered among the gray vegetation. "What is this?" Emma demanded. "Some kind of dark fairy magic?" Mark shook his head. "I have never seen any blight such as this before. I do not like it. Let us make haste away." No one argued, but as they hurried through the ghost towns and across the hills, they saw several more patches of the ugly blight. At last, the sky began to turn light with dawn. All of them were nearly dropping with exhaustion as they left the road behind and found themselves in a place of trees and rolling hills. "We can rest here," said Mark. He pointed to a rise of ground opposite, whose top was hidden by a number of stone cairns. "Those will give us some shelter and some cover." Emma frowned. "I hear water," she said. "Is there a stream?"
"You know we can't drink the water here," Julian said as she picked her way downhill toward the sound of fluid bubbling over rocks and around tree roots.
"I know, but at least we can wash off in it." Her voice died.
There was a stream, of sorts, bisecting the valley between the two low hills. But the water wasn't water. It was scarlet and thick. It moved sluggishly, slow and red and dripping between the black trunks of trees.
"All the blood that's shed on earth runs through the springs of that country," said Mark at her elbow. "You quoted that to me."
Julian moved to the edge of the blood stream and knelt down. With a quick gesture, he dipped his fingers in. It came out scarlet. "It clots," he said, frowning in mixed fascination and disgust, and wiped his hand off on the grass. "Is it really human blood?"
"That's what they say," said Mark.
"Not all the rivers of Faerie are like this, but they claim that the blood of the murdered dead of the human world runs through the streams and creeks and springs here in the woods."
"Who is they?" Julian asked, standing up. "Who says that?"
"Kieran," said Mark simply.
"I know the story too," said Christina. "There are different versions of the legends, but I have heard many, and most say that the blood is human, mundane blood."
She backed up, took a running jump, and landed on the other side of the bloody stream with some feet to spare. The rest of them followed her and trudged up the hill to a flat grassy top, which commanded a view of the surrounding countryside. Emma suspected the cairns of crumbled stones had once been a watchtower of some sort. They unrolled the blankets they had and spread out coats, huddling under them for warmth. Mark curled up and immediately fell asleep. Christina lay down more cautiously, her body wrapped in her dark blue coat, her long hair spilling over the arm on which her head rested. Emma found a place for herself on the grass, folding her gear up to make a pillow. She had nothing to wrap herself in and shivered when her skin touched the cold ground as she reached to balance Cortana carefully on a nearby stone.
"Emma."
It was Julian, rolling over toward her. He'd been so still she thought he was asleep.
She didn't even remember lying down close to him. In the dawn light, his eyes glowed like sea glass.
I've got a spare blanket. Take it. It was soft and gray, a thin coverlet that used to lie across the foot of his bed.
Forcibly, Emma pushed away memories of waking up with it bunched around her feet, yawning and stretching in the sunlight of Julian's room.
Thanks, she whispered, sliding under the blanket.
The grass was dampening with dew. Julian was still watching her, his head resting on his curved arm.
Jules, Emma whispered, if our witch light doesn't work here, and seraph blades don't work here, and runes don't work here, what does that mean?
He sounded weary.
When I looked into an inn in one of the towns we passed, I saw an angelic rune someone had scrawled on the wall. It was spattered in blood, scratched and defaced. I don't know what's happened here since the cold peace, but I know they hate us.
Do you think Christina's pendant will still work? Emma said.
I think it's just shadow hunter magic that's blocked here, Julian said.
Christina's pendant was a fairy gift. It should be all right.
Emma nodded. Good night, Jules, she whispered.
He smiled faintly.
It's morning, Emma.
She didn't say anything, only closed her eyes. But not all the way, so she could still see him. She hadn't slept near him since that terrible day Jem had told her about Parabatai and their curse. And she didn't realize how much she had missed it. She was exhausted, her tiredness seeping out of her bones and into the ground beneath her as her aching body relaxed. She had forgotten what it was like to let consciousness go slowly, as the person she trusted most in the world lay beside her. Even here in Faerie, where shadow hunters were hated, she felt safer than she had been in her own bedroom alone, because Jules was there, so close that if she'd reached out, she could have touched him. She couldn't reach out, of course, couldn't touch him. But they were breathing close together, breathing the same breath as consciousness fragmented, as Emma let go of wakefulness and fell, the image of Julian in the dawn light following her down into dreams.
Chapter 9. These Lands. Kit soon had a new item to add to his list of things he didn't like about shadow hunters. They wake me up in the middle of the night. It was Livy who woke him up specifically, shaking him out of a dream of mantid demons. He sat up, gasping, a knife in his hand, one of the daggers he'd taken from the weapons room. It had been on his nightstand, and he had no recollection of picking it up.
Not bad, Livy said. She was hovering over his bed, her hair tied back, her gear half invisible in the darkness.
Fast reflexes.
The knife was about an inch from her chest, but she didn't move. Kit let it clatter back to the nightstand.
You've got to be kidding me.
Get up, she said. Ty just saw Zara sneak out of the front door. We're tracking her.
You're what?
Kit got yawning out of bed, only to be handed a pile of dark clothes by Livy. She raised her eyebrows at the sight of his boxers, but made no other comment.
Put your gear on, she said. We'll explain on the way.
She headed out of the room, leaving Kit to change. He had always wondered what Shadowhunter gear would feel like. The boots, pants, shirt, and jacket of sturdy dark material and heavy weapons belt looked uncomfortable, but they weren't. The gear was light and flexible on, despite being so tough that when he took the dagger from his bedside and tried to cut the arm of the jacket, the blade didn't even part the material. The boots seemed to fit immediately, like the ring, and the weapons belt sat light and snug around his hips.
"Do I look all right?" he asked, appearing in the hall.
Ty was gazing thoughtfully at his closed right hand, a rune glimmering on the back of it. Livy gave Kit a thumbs up.
You absolutely could have been rejected from the yearly Hot Shadowhunters calendar.
Rejected? Kit demanded as they started downstairs. Her eyes were dancing.
For being too young, of course.
There is no Hot Shadowhunters calendar, said Ty.
Both of you be quiet. We need to get out of this house without being spotted.
They crept out the back way and down the road toward the beach, careful to avoid the night patrol. Livy whispered to Kit that Ty was holding a hair clip that Zara had left on a table. It worked as a sort of homing beacon, pulling them in her direction. She seemed to have gone down to the beach and then walked along the sand. Livy pointed to her footprints in the process of being washed away by the rising tide. "Could have been a mundane," said Kit, for argument's sake.
"Following the exact path," Livy said.
"Look, we're even zigging and zagging where she did." Kit couldn't really argue. He set his mind to keeping up with Ty, who was practically flying over the dunes of sand and the boulders and uneven rocks that dotted the coastline more thickly as they moved north. He scaled an alarmingly tall wall of pitted rock and dropped down on the other side. Kit, following, almost tripped and landed face first in the sand. He managed to regain his footing and was relieved. He wasn't sure who he least wanted to look like a fool in front of, Livy or Ty. Maybe it was an equal split.
"There," Ty said in a whisper, pointing to where a dark hole opened up in the rocky wall of the bluff that rose to divide the beach from the highway.
Tumbled piles of rock jutted out into the ocean, where waves broke around them, casting silvery white spray high into the air. The sand had given way to a rocky reef. They picked their way carefully across it, even Ty, who bent to examine something in a tide pool. He straightened with a smile and a starfish in his hand.
"Ty," said Livy, "put it back, unless you're planning on throwing it at Zara."
"Waste of a perfectly good starfish," muttered Kit, and Ty laughed.
The salt air had tangled his arrow-straight black hair, and his eyes glowed like the moonlight on the water. Kit just stared, unable to think of anything else clever to say, as Ty gently placed the starfish back in its tide pool. They made it to the cave opening without any of the stops for wildlife. Livy went in first, with Ty and Kit following. Kit paused as the darkness of the cave enveloped him.
"I can't see," he said, trying to fight his rising panic. He hated the pitch dark, but then who didn't?
Light burst around him like the sudden appearance of a falling star. It was witch light. Ty was holding it.
"Do you want a night vision rune?" Livy asked, her hand on her steely.
Kit shook his head.
"No runes," he said.
He wasn't sure why he was insisting. It wasn't as if the Urazi had heard. It just seemed like the final hurdle, the last admission that he was a shadow hunter, not just a boy with shadow hunter blood who had decided to make the Institute a way station while he figured out a better plan. Whatever that plan might be. Kit tried not to brood on it as they advanced deeper into the tunnels.
"Do you think this is part of the convergence?" he heard Livy whisper.
Ty shook his head.
"No. The bluffs of the coast are riddled with caves. Always have been. I mean, anything could be down here. Nests of demons, vampires. But I don't think this has anything to do with Malcolm. And the ley lines are nowhere near here."
"I really wish you hadn't said nests of demons," said Kit. "Makes them sound like spiders."
"Some demons are spiders," said Ty. "The biggest one ever reported was 20 feet tall and had yard-long mandibles." Kit thought of the giant praying mantis demons that had ripped his father apart. It was hard to think of anything witty to say about a giant spider when you'd seen the white of your father's rib cage.
"Shh," Livy held up her hand. "I hear voices."
Kit strained his ears but heard nothing. He suspected there was another rune he was lacking, something that would give him Superman hearing. He could see lights moving up ahead, though, around the curve of the tunnel. They moved ahead, Kit staying to the rear of Ty and Livy. The tunnel opened out into a massive chamber, a room with cracked granite walls, a packed earth floor, and a smell of mold and decay. The ceiling rose into blackness. There was a small wooden table and two chairs in the middle of the room. The only light came from rune stones placed on the table. One chair was occupied by Zara. Kit pressed himself instinctively back against the wall on the other side of the tunnel. Livy and Ty did the same. Zara was examining some papers she'd spread on the table.
There was a bottle of wine and a glass at her elbow. She wasn't dressed in gear, but in a plain dark suit, her hair drawn back into an impossibly tight bun. Kit strained to see what she was studying, but he was too far away. He could read some words etched into the table, though. Fire wants to burn. He had no idea what they meant. Zara didn't seem to be doing anything interesting, either. Maybe she just came here to have privacy for her reading. Maybe she was secretly tired of Perfect Diego and was hiding. Who could blame her? Zara looked up, her eyebrows creasing. Someone was coming. Kit heard the quick tread of feet, and a tousled-haired figure in jeans appeared at the far end of the room.
"It's Manuel," Livy whispered. "Maybe they're having an affair?"
"Manu," Zara said, frowning. She didn't sound lovelorn.
"You're late."
"Sorry." Manuel grinned a disarming grin and grabbed for the free chair, swinging it around so he could seat himself with his arms folded over the back. "Don't be cross, Zara. I had to wait until Rayon and John fell asleep. They were in a chatty mood, and I didn't want to chance anyone seeing me leave the Institute." He indicated the papers. "What have you got there?"
"Updates from my father," Zara said. "He was disappointed about the outcome of the last council, obviously. The decision to let that half-breed Mark Blackthorne remain among decent Nephilim would offend anyone."
Manuel picked up a glass of wine. Red lights glinted in its depths.
"Still, we must look to the future," he said. "Getting rid of Mark wasn't the point of our journey here, after all. He's a minor annoyance, like his siblings."
Ty, Kit, and Livy exchanged confused looks. Livy's face was tight with anger. Ty's was expressionless, but his hands moved restlessly at his sides.
"True, the first step is the registry," Zara said. She patted the papers, making them rustle. "My father says the cohort is strong in Idris, and they believe the Los Angeles Institute is ripe for the plucking. The incident with Malcolm sowed considerable doubt in the West Coast's ability to make judgments, and the fact that the High Warlock of Los Angeles and the head of the local vampire clan both turned out to be enmeshed in dark magic..."
"That wasn't our fault," Livy whispered. "There was no way to possibly know." Ty shushed her, but Kit had missed the last of what Zara was saying. He was only conscious of her grin like a dark red slash across her face.
"Confidence isn't very high," she finished.
"And Arthur," said Manuel, "the putative head of the place? Not that I've laid eyes on him once."
"A lunatic," said Zara. "My father told me he suspected as much. He knew him at the academy. I talked to Arthur myself. He thought I was someone named Amatus."
Kit glanced at Livy, who gave a puzzled shrug.
"It will be easy enough to put him in front of the council and prove he's a madman," said Zara. "I can't say who's been running the Institute in his stead. Diana, I imagine. But if she'd wanted the head position, she'd have taken it already."
"So your father steps in, the cohort makes sure he carries the vote, and the Institute is his," said Manuel.
"Ours," Zara corrected. "I will run the Institute by his side. He trusts me. We'll be a team."
Manuel didn't seem impressed. He'd probably heard it before. "And then the registry."
"Absolutely. We'll be able to propose it as a law immediately, and once it passes, we can begin the identifications."
Zara's eyes glittered. "Every downworlder will wear the sign." Kit's stomach lurched. This was close enough to mundane history to make him taste bile in the back of his throat.
"We can start at the shadow market," said Zara. "The creatures congregate there. If we take enough of them into custody, we should be able to seize the rest for registration soon enough."
"And if they're not inclined to be registered, then they can be convinced easily enough with a little pain," said Manuel. Zara frowned.
"I think you enjoy the torture, Manu."
He leaned forward, elbows on the table, his face open and handsome and charming. "I think you do too, Zara. I've seen you admiring my work." He flexed his fingers. "You just don't want to admit it in front of Perfect Diego."
"Seriously, they call him that too?" Kit muttered under his breath.
Zara tossed her head, but Manuel was grinning.
You're going to have to tell him eventually about the cohort's full plans, he said. You know he won't approve. He's a downworlder lover, if there ever was one. Zara made a disgusted noise.
Nonsense. He's nothing like that disgusting Alec Lightwood and his stupid alliance and his repulsive demon spawn boyfriend. The Blackthorns may be fairy-loving morons, but Diego's just confused.
What about Emma Carstairs?
Zara began gathering up the pages of her father's letter. She didn't look at Manuel.
What about her?
Everyone says she's the best shadow hunter since Jace Herondale, said Manuel, a title I know you've long coveted for yourself.
Vanessa Ashdown says she's a boy-crazy slut,
said Zara, and the ugly words seemed to echo off the rock walls.
Kit thought of Emma with her sword, Emma saving his life, Emma hugging Christina and looking at Julian like he hung the moon. And he wondered if he could get away with stomping on Zara's foot the next time he saw her.
And I haven't been particularly impressed by her in person. She's quite ordinary.
I'm sure she is, said Manuel as Zara rose to her feet, papers in hand.
I still don't understand what you see in Diego.
You wouldn't. It's a family alliance.
An arranged marriage? How mundane and medieval.
Manuel grabbed for the rune stones on the table. For a moment, the light in the room seemed to dance, a wild pattern of shine and shadow.
So, are we heading back?
We'd better. If anyone sees us, we can say we were checking the wards.
Zara crumpled the pages of her father's letter and stuffed them into her pocket. The council meets.